I'll call the meeting to order. We at one time had a quorum. And the first bill we're going to hear is House File 1918, Representative Finstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment which will eliminate, from what I've been told, all the controversy. So,
Representative Finstad, does that mean I can erase about 100 emails?
Yeah, I apologize for that, Mr. Chair. But yeah, I would, if we have enough people going, I'd offer the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment has been offered. Why don't you move your bill first and move to be sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move House File 1918 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at this time, then, I would move the A1 amendment, which does eliminate the controversy dealing with athletic trainers and would drastically clean up and clear out your emails.
So, Representative Finstad, then this amendment, there's no reference to athletic trainers left in the bill?
That is my understanding, but with me, I have a testifier to address that a little bit further.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Stephanie Lenny from the Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy. There are no references left to athletic trainers in the bill with that amendment. Would you like me to start with?
Why don't you give us a brief synopsis of the bill?
Okay.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair, should we remove the amendment? Should we take care of that first?
Let's
and then
move
we
the
can.
Amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment is adopted. Now the bill is amended.
Thank you.
Okay. I did provide you with some background information, even though the amendment does remove all athletic trainers from the bill, because we will end up needing to come back next year with different language, and that is the larger packet with a couple of tabs on it that you received. But basically, quickly, the overview of the Physical Therapist Practice Act has three people: the physical therapist assistant, and the physical therapy aide. The Athletic Trainers Practice Act says that athletic trainers can provide services in physical therapy when they work under direct supervision. In addition, there was a U.S. District Court order this summer that says that a more sensible reading is that a physical therapist needs to supervise athletic trainers, because the legislature intended athletic trainers to provide physical therapy. But in sum, the Minnesota legislature, this is the judge's order, intended athletic trainers to work under direct supervision and did not intend for athletic trainers to function only as aides, which leaves sort of this limbo situation of lack of clarity as to what the restrictions on athletic trainers should be, and a lack of accountability and transparency. So we will be working with the athletic trainers, the PT Association, and various interested parties, and probably be back to see you next year with this. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on the bill? Okay. Anybody in the audience wish to testify on this bill?
Chairman Huntley and members of the committee, my name is Judy Hawley, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. I just wanted to let you know that this technical correction bill has been reviewed by our physical therapy community, and we fully support the bill as amended.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? You want to renew your motion, then, Mr. Finstad?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, we'll renew my motion that House File 1918, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
As amended.
As amended, yes. All those in favor?
No. We're just... did you say recommend to pass?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And it actually would be nice if between now and next year, the athletic trainers and the physical therapists could get together and figure out how they could craft that language.
I will do, Mr. Chair, I will do what I can to make sure the two groups get a chance to work together.
Okay, next we'll have House File 1881, Representative Powell. And I'll move that House File 1881 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also, get it in shape, would like to have the AO5-0321 amendment.
I would move that amendment. Representative Powell, do you want to describe the amendment?
Basically, it takes all the controversy out of the bill. That's the easy answer. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board had, along with the Attorney General's Office, had decided that perhaps we should try to put some language in law that would license tribal ambulance services. However, after the bill was crafted and after talking with numerous tribes, it was been decided that that probably isn't a good idea with this bill. And so what this amendment does is conform 1881 to the Senate language, which is moving through the process now.
Okay, so that's the discussion of the amendment. Anybody else have any questions on the amendment? All those in favor of 0321 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we now have the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With me today is the Executive Director of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, Mary Hedges, to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Fallon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a housekeeping bill that the EMS Regulatory Board is crafted in support of making a few changes to our authorizing statutes. And we have, at this point, with the amendment that Representative Powell introduced, there really is no opposition to this bill as far as I know. The first section, what we did was, we do have about six tribal ambulance services, and we've had them for a number of years. And when the sixth one asked to be recognized by the board last year, to get an ambulance license, we realized the Attorney General's office pointed out that we don't have anything in our statute that says we can license tribes. So this is just a cleanup to add that to the statute since we've actually been doing it for a number of years. The part that was real controversial was when some extra language that the AG put in requiring additional agreements from the tribe, such as accepting, agreeing to be liable, and so on and so forth. And we realized that this was certainly not necessary because we've always had good cooperation and good ambulance support, good ambulance services from the tribal ambulance services. So that's the part that was removed. Also, another part of the bill, we proposed to increase the earnings limit for volunteer ambulance attendant. This does not have any fiscal impact as what it does, right now our law says a volunteer ambulance attendant can earn up to $3,000 a year, and the nonprofit ambulance service can still apply for reimbursement for their training through our board. We know that limit has not increased for a number of years, and a lot of the volunteers are having to work more hours. So the proposal was to increase that limit to $6,000 a year. Clearly, it's not anything that a volunteer could live on, but it's they do get paid in many cases a little stipend for their time spent going on ambulance calls. The other major piece of this bill is with all the emphasis on terrorism preparedness and planning for those disasters that we don't want to think about, we needed some provision in our statute which exempted ambulance services from some of the more onerous requirements in the time of a disaster. So we went through this statute and found the requirements that probably would not be necessary, in our opinion, in the times of a disaster that was declared through the appropriate channels. And these, what we're asking here is those certain provisions of the law be suspended in a legally declared disaster. The final piece is just some language adding that before a person is certified as an EMT or first responder or paramedic, they complete a form approved, an application form approved by the board. Thank you.
Are there any questions, Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, I heard you talk about the $6,000 annually. Where does that number come from?
It's a number that the money comes from the ambulance service paying the individual.
I understand. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Maybe I need to make it more clear. How'd you come up with $6,000? Did you put different numbers in a hat and pull this one out? And I know that sounds flippant, but I'm trying to make it clear. Is there some basis for this number that you took it from somewhere else? Or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is the 3,000 limit had not been changed for a number of years, and last year the voluntary earnings limit was increased for another program that we have for retiring ambulance volunteers, and that was increased to 6,000. So it made sense to make this consistent with that provision. And in terms of a scientific way of determining that, no, there was not really any scientific way. It's just that we knew a number of individuals were on the brink earning $4,000, and we didn't want to have to come back and change that every year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. I don't know if that explains where it comes from, but I guess I'll move on to Subdivision 3. Is there a tribe that currently has would like to be licensed?
Ms. Hedges.
Mr. Chair, Representative and members of the committee, actually, we've long had six tribes that run their own ambulance services that are licensed, and they cover tribal land and non-tribal land, and they serve, you know, members of the tribe and anyone else that needs to be served. And last year we had a sixth request, which when we were working with the AG to approve that, he happened to notice that our statute doesn't specifically name tribes and pointed out that we needed to add it to the statute. The reason they do want to have a license, typically tribes, you know, will often say a license is not necessary, but I think the motivation here is in order to get reimbursed by Medicare, they need a license, so that if they do want that.
Representative Emmer.
One more, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My last question has to do with the reference to Chapter 466, the discretionary immunities that we grant to our municipalities. And I suppose this is a question more appropriately directed to Representative Powell. The reason in history that we created Chapter 466 was because we got away from that the king could do no wrong line of or law, but originally when it was passed, and we just had this on another bill, so I think you'll remember, you were the municipality got the benefit of the cap, or if they bought insurance up to the limit of that that available insurance. My question is, why if the tribe is waiving its sovereign immunity, why don't we have that language that allows them to be responsible above the, I think it's 300, 600 right now in Chapter 466. Why wasn't provision made to allow it to be the higher number in the event they are insured above that?
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Emmer, I think the broad general answer is this, is that those were the types of discussions I think that the Attorney General's office was thinking of initially when they got involved with this. But what we found was is that when you're looking at sovereign immunity with the tribes, it's a very touchy subject with that. And I certainly, we did not want to scuttle the bill with language that was going to harm the rest of the bill moving forward. So basically what we've chosen to do is delete any references generally to the tribe's sovereign immunity and licensing for them and moved on with the rest of it. And consequently, it made it a bill that really has nobody working against it, and everybody is supported.
Representative Emmer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. That just brings up one follow-up then, because it does say on page 2 at line 20, notwithstanding, and I'll paraphrase, blah, 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 to waive its sovereign immunity with respect to claims arising from the liability. So it does say that they're going to waive their sovereign immunity. Do the tribes then have to execute some other document in order to make that effective?
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I'm sorry. I missed the last part of your question, but the second part is this. That is part that we've removed by the amendment. We've just we've removed that part.
Thank you.
Any other discussion on the bill as amended? Seeing none, then I will renew my motion that House File 1881 be recommended to pass and sent to the as amended sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
I have this, seriously, I have this about 50% hearing in the one ear. It happens to be the one that's facing
all those that showed up.
So, if you could just, all those in favor, if you just raise your hands up. So. Doesn't pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commitment.
Pardon?
Just thanking the committee.
Okay. Amendment is not passed. Or the bill is not passed. Is Ruth? We'll now do House File 1272, Representative Ruth. And again, I will move that House File 1272 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have, with the House File 1272 includes marriage and family therapists in the list of professionals authorized to practice any of the categories of services in combination with the individuals that are organized under that chapter. And I have experts here that know much more about this than I do, so I could say it's a very simple bill, but I'll say it's a very difficult bill, and then maybe the reverse psychology works. I don't know if this will help. But immediately to my right is Dr. Melkow, who is a family marriage and family therapist and lives in the incredible city of Owatonna. And so I will introduce him at this point, if that's okay.
Mr. Melkow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The issue that we're bringing up came to my attention approximately a year ago when I was involved with a group that was attempting to buy out some outpatient mental health clinics from Blue Cross Blue Shield, who was my employer at the time. And as we put this group together, it came to our awareness that because of 319B, I'm not actually eligible to be in ownership of the clinics. And so the buyout went through, and I have invested in them, but I'm not actually legally listed as an owner at this point. And subsequent to that, I contacted Representative Ruth and members of my board to see if we can do something to change the status of that so I can not only be an owner, or I can be legally be an owner, not just somebody who put money down in terms of being able to purchase the clinics and outright.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also have with us Briar Miller from the Minnesota Association of Marriage, Marriage and Family Therapists, and Bob Butler, who's from the Minnesota Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. And if there are no questions at this point, perhaps they could proceed.
Okay.
We might.
Which one?
My name is Briar Miller, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm the president of the Minnesota Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and we are here to give full support from our membership. As far as we can see, having researched this, this is nothing more than an oversight, and that our inclusion in the Professional Firms Act would not intrude on any privileges or rights or of any other professional, but would allow our licensees to be able to purchase a professional firm, much like Dr. McCall was describing, in collaboration with other professionals that are already listed in the Professional Firms Act, such as medical doctors, psychologists, and social workers. And just one last point that I would make is that marriage and family therapy is a full-fledged mental health profession, as is psychology and social work under the Comprehensive Mental Health Bill or Mental Health Act. So that's why we're framing this. We've had licensure since the late 80s, that this is just correcting an oversight. Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this doesn't have anything to do with billing? In other words, by getting included, my concern when I first saw it was that it was somehow impacting when you file an insurance form, a Form 1500. It has nothing to do with that.
No, it has. It has no implications for billing.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions for Ms. Miller? And Mr. Butler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Butler, and I'm the executive director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. I know you frequently see professional associations and boards on opposite sides of the fence. We're on the same side today. During the month of February, the board discussed the inclusion of marriage and family therapists in 319B, and with all members present, the board unanimously voted to support the inclusion as it's proposed here today. I think Breyer is right. The fact that the MFTs have not been in this bill previously is simply an oversight, and perhaps an oversight on the part of the board as it had gone with housekeeping bills and those kinds of things over the year. But the board totally supports the inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Butler? And Representative Ruth, is Mr. Miner here?
Yes, but Mr. Chair, we don't need to have any more testimony unless there's a question that you have.
Okay.
But he is here, and we just felt that this is probably enough to be cognizance of the time that we have. And I also would just point out, I think Representative Emmer had a good point with the dollars, just to point out that it is a zero fiscal impact. I have a fiscal note, zero.
Well, we appreciate the brevity given the huge number of bills we have here tonight. So, is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there any further discussion from members? Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 1272 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Ruth. We can do House File 575, Representative Sharon. Saw him here a minute ago. Oh, there he is. And Representative, I am Irish, so if you want to use the same accent you did on the House floor.
No, that was the one performance only. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Looks like I'll move House File 575 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Strong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment, and I think it was distributed in your packets. It's the A1 amendment. Just trying to get the bill in the form we'd like it here.
Okay, I would move that the amendment 575A1 be passed. And would you describe the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the amendment basically narrows the scope of how this bill would be effective. Right now, as the bill is written, it would be very broad and would accept licensure from any state or possession or the District of Columbia. And the amendment would ask that reciprocal licensure be granted for contiguous states to the state of Minnesota, just in our region.
Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You want to now describe the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have with me today my constituents, Clint and Sybilla Gridley. They're from Woodbury. Mr. Gridley is currently the city administrator in the city of Woodbury. Mrs. Gridley is a physical therapist. She's been practicing for the last 22 years. She has been licensed and practiced in the European Union, in the state of Wisconsin, in the state of Illinois, in the state of Ohio. And I would like, and I'm here to, I was happy to take up this bill at their request, not only because it affects one constituent, but that I think it has broader importance than that. So with that, I'll have Mrs. Gridley give her testimony.
Okay, Mrs. Gridley.
Hey, my name is Sybilla Gridley. I'm coming before you today to ask for your support to voting for the House Bill 575, which provides for reciprocal licensure for physical therapists who have practiced 5 out of 7 years in another state of the United States. The proposed language is the same statutory language as lawyers have coming into the state. It's been well documented that the cost of health care is a major source of financial stress for the state, private company, and personal budget. The cost of health care services is directly impacted by availability, supply of health care professionals. Unfortunately, the state legislature has unwittingly limited the supply of physical therapists through overly restrictive licensing statutes as administered by the Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy that applies to statutes in a literalist fashion that effectively reduces the pool of available physical therapists, raising the cost for these professionals. With 1 million additional people projected to move into the Twin Cities area and the aging of the population, the demand for physical therapists will only expand and have more serious cost implications for the state and other parties. Moreover, in this increasingly mobile society, it will be important for states' job competitiveness to reduce red tape and to be more open in terms of accepting professionals from other states with practical experiences and prior licenses. If a professional cannot practice in Minnesota, they in turn may not move here, hurting the competitiveness of a state compared to others. Let me illustrate the problem with the current law with my personal experience. I am a physical therapist who moved to the state in August of last year. I've been practicing physical therapy for over 22 years and have been licensed in the states of Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin over the last 20 years, as well as in Germany, my native country. In trying to obtain licensure in this state, I've encountered nothing but roadblocks and problems. Let me summarize my difficulties. First, the law does not consider total educational credits and regulates the minimum credit hours for both specific and general credits. I have the equivalent of a bachelor's degree of physical therapy with 116 credit hours in professional education, 60 are required by Minnesota law, and 146 in total, which far exceeds the requirements for physical therapists by 26 credit hours. The licensing board wants me to A, have my credentials evaluated over again, specifically a comprehensive credentials evaluation type 1 certificate from the FCCPT, which on their own website states is primarily used for the individual who has never been licensed in the U.S., which is not true for me. And B, the licensing board wants me to acquire another 30 credit hours in general education. I have supervised students during their clinical internships. I've taken numerous continuing education courses and have co-taught continuing education courses, and I do not believe that this action makes me more qualified to practice physical therapy. Second, the minimum state board exam score is higher than other states and does not consider the full portfolio of experience, licensure, and education. I have taken the state board exam 20 years ago, and my scores have been accepted in all three states I have applied for licensure. Yet, since I have been told I fall a point and a half short of the Minnesota board requirements, I'm told that I have to take it over again. There's been no recognition of my past experience, prior acceptances, and current licenses. Third, verification of licensure is excessive. The board requires verification of licensure by sending a specific form to the states I have held licenses and to be sent directly from these states to the Minnesota board. This poses a problem with my German license, since I never had to be in contact with this government agency. Licensure is handled by the physical therapy school and does not need to be renewed. I have no idea where to send such a request, and that it would be even completed by the appropriate officials and in due time. Other official documents have taken years to be processed. I do have an officially translated and notarized copy of my German license, which the board rejects. Fourth, the additional requirements the board could impose at their discretion, for example, a 6-month supervised traineeship at a facility approved by the board. I understand that the purpose of the rules and regulations are to make sure only qualified therapists can practice in Minnesota and to protect the public from harm. The question is, how does the board define qualification? Within the existing law, I had hoped each applicant would be considered individually. There's always discretion that can be used in the interpretation and application of rules and regulations, as most government entities do. All situations are not equal. If the board wants to be fair, as they say they do, those circumstances need to be considered. Since the board will not consider the full experience of an applicant and will not use discretionary judgments, then a revision of the state statute is needed to keep Minnesota competitive with the other marketplaces. Everything I've encountered gives me the impression that Minnesota is a closed shop state for physical therapists that have not been trained and taken the exam here. A new Minnesota graduate seems to be more qualified than I, who has over 22 years of experience, which does not seem to be count for anything in the state. In this world of a mobile society, a global economy, an increasing number of patients given the growth of the region and the aging of the population, there's no reason I can see for the board that now exists to restrict licensed therapists from other states to practice in Minnesota. There are already many steps in place that a physical therapist has to prove him or herself before one can become a physical therapist. Excellent grades, acceptance into a physical therapy program, successfully graduating from such a program, taking and passing a national exam, and applying for licensure, and in many states, continued education to maintain licensure. As a physical therapist, I can practice my profession in most countries in Europe, yet I can't move from one state to another and practice. There are already several areas of reciprocity in place, such as the university system and for attorneys. Even though the body of law differs from state to state, the human body doesn't. Not to give reciprocity hurts not just myself, but it hurts patients and taxpayers with ever-increasing healthcare costs. One would hope the licensing board would evaluate one's background in light of their criteria and recognize that current and past licenses, experience and education that meet the standard and intended call for in the statutes. In not doing so, it seems the board has not the best interest of patients in mind, but in restricting qualified therapists to come in and compete for jobs. The same patients I could not treat here, I could treat 15 minutes across the border. That defies all logic and practicality. In closing, let me say this bill before you is not just about me and not just about my situation. It's about recognizing the changes in society and facilitating supply of therapists to keep them available and affordable. I understand the Minnesota Physical Therapy Association does not support this change, protecting the job interests of their members. I ask you to protect the interests of taxpayers, patients, and potential employees like me. I thank you for the opportunity to address you and respectfully ask you to support this bill to allow physical therapists who have practiced under the laws of another state of the United States for 5 of the preceding 7 years to be licensed in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Mrs. Gridley, could you go someplace in there you talked about, and I sort of missed, you talked about practicing with supervision, I think, for 6 months. Is that a possibility or something?
That's a possibility. That's upon their discretion if they decide that I have not worked enough under supervision in the United States, which I have.
Any questions at this time? Representative Dean.
I'm sorry, is it Ms. Simmel?
Sibylla.
What is the national organization that kind of oversees or governs your profession? Do you have like a professional?
The Physical Therapy Association.
And is there national guidelines for licensure or reciprocal licensure within that agency?
Not that I'm aware of. It usually is done state by state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sympathize with you, obviously you're very, very well qualified and obviously should be practicing here in Minnesota. And I have, as a friend who's trying to gain licensure as an architect in Minnesota from another country, and the red tape is just absolutely perplexing, so I sympathize with your situation. But it seems to me that perhaps this is an issue with licensure and with red tape in Minnesota, less so than with reciprocity. Perhaps it's a problem of our own licensure, and perhaps your national boards need to really step up to the plate and establish some credible guidelines, as other professions do, like medicine, law, and architecture, that perhaps that's what needs to happen rather than our own. Perhaps we're not treating the real problem, but yeah. Perhaps the reciprocity issue. Could you talk to that a little bit?
That would be very desirable, and I know from other colleagues who have complained about this, that they cannot move from state to state in practice, that it should be, and it already is a national exam. It's just that different states require different scores and have their own requirements of what it takes to be licensed in one state, and I don't know how that can be changed. The state of Ohio, for example, does give reciprocity. I had no problem going from Illinois to Ohio to be licensed there.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Yeah, I was wondering, Mr. Sharon, Representative Sharon, if this is, if you have found that there are other persons that are in the same situation. If there are other people that are looking from other states that are looking to be licensed here, I'm just trying to get an idea of the scope of the problem.
I have not been in contact with anyone else, but I have assumed that there are.
Okay.
Anecdotally.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have to applaud Representative Schroen for really taking care of your constituents here. This seems like a pretty individualized case, so my question then would be to Ms. Gridley. You talked a little bit about the reciprocity between, did you say Ohio and Illinois? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Within your national organization's structure, tell me a little bit about reciprocity throughout the rest of the states. By us doing this, would we be the first state to accept other state standards? I mean, there needs to be something needs to be said about the reason that we've created our own standards within the state of Minnesota. So my question is, do other states accept other states' standards, or are we...
The one I know of is Ohio, because that's the state I have applied for and received licensure. I also licensed in Wisconsin after I had been licensed in Illinois and Ohio. And that was more of a laborious process, but I received my license.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you moved to Wisconsin, did you push their legislature then to get reciprocity from Ohio?
That fortunately wasn't necessary.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Any other questions? We have three people signed up to testify against. Does the other witness want to talk in favor there? Or?
I don't think so at this time. We'll
okay. Well, why don't we hear from, they can all come up together, Stephanie Lenning, Carmella Claypool, and Kathleen Picard. If they're here. We can start with she's first on the list, Ms. Lenning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stephanie Lenning from the Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy, and the Board of Physical Therapy is not in favor of House File 575 because standards have been established in our Practice Act, and those standards were established to protect the public. Reciprocity is basically ignoring Minnesota standards and accepting whatever the standard might be in another state. This is a fairly new amendment, and I can't say that anybody has had a chance to investigate what those standards are in the contiguous states. It basically shifts the responsibility from our licensing board and relies on the other licensing boards that they've done a thorough job of checking it out, out each applicant, as well as not knowing exactly what their standards are. There's a handout that you're receiving that sort of, it's a flow chart that takes you through the licensure process for a foreign educated physical therapist. It is a process that sort of has three prongs to it, and Ms. Gridley is not an applicant with the Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy. If she were, I would not even be able to talk, to even acknowledge her name in public, because that would be private information. So I am very sorry that she's confused by the process. We are a small agency with a staff of two, and we really put a lot of energy into customer service and trying to be very thorough in explaining and helping people through the process. But basically, what a physical therapist who applies in Minnesota needs to do, there are three boxes on about the bottom two or one-third of the page. The physical therapist needs to have their educational credentials need to meet the Minnesota standards. If they don't, it doesn't mean they can't get licensed. They can take CLEP tests and test out of if they're short credits, or they can take additional credits. And then when they successfully, you know, have the required education, they'll have that requirement done. But without even having a chance to review Ms. Gridley's application or her education, we really can't make a ruling on whether her education does or does not meet Minnesota requirements. The second part of the Minnesota requirement for an educated physical therapist is a six-month supervised traineeship. It's very clear in the statute that may be waived if the person has practiced under supervision for 6 months elsewhere in the country. So that one, for an experienced physical therapist, very often is waived. That's usually not a problem for folks who practice elsewhere. And then they have to have a passing score on the national licensing exam. Minnesota established in 1970 a passing score of one standard deviation below the mean. Other states established other passing scores. So there is a variety. You know, some states have a 1.5 standard deviations below the mean, and some even have 2 standard deviations below the mean, which is just about, I mean, the academics in this room have a pretty good appreciation of how low 2 standard deviations below the mean take you. But as of 1995, there was a standard passing score. They redid the exam. It's criterion-based. It's you know, it's a total shift in how the exam is being scored. So those are the 3 basic big requirements. There's nothing that keeps somebody from getting a license if they meet those requirements. And even if they didn't meet them at first, they can, you know, they can retake the exam. They could do additional coursework if necessary. I guess I would ask the committee to, you know, consider this very carefully. The bill remains very broad. It says practiced in another state for 5 out of the 7 years, but it doesn't say how much practice. I mean, is this, you know, could somebody practice, you know, one day every 6 weeks and over 5 years, and that would add up to about 320 hours total of practice in 5 years. And with the language as it's written, that would say that they practiced for 5 years in another state. It doesn't even actually require licensure in another state. I mean, so there's some things that I think in conjunction with studying actually what standards we would be accepting if we did do reciprocity and accept all the standards around us, going into that with our eyes wide open of knowing what those changes would be, as well as probably being more specific in terms of you know, that trade-off between if they don't have the educational credentials and they don't have a passing score, how many, you know, did they have adequate hours of practice so that the legislature feels like public protection is being provided. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Lenning? None. Ms. Claypool.
Chairman Hanley and members of the Licensing Subcommittee. My name is Carmela Jurado Claypool, and I'm a physical therapist licensed to practice in Minnesota. I also happen to be a foreign-trained physical therapist. I am here to urge you to vote no to HF 575, the Physical Therapist Licensure Reciprocity Bill. I've been a physical therapist for 33 years, and for 17 of those years, I have practiced in Minnesota. I graduated from San Marcos University in Lima, Peru in 1972. I came to the University of Minnesota in 1986 as a Fulbright scholar and took some classes in geriatrics. I then returned to Peru. In 1988, I returned to the United States and I started the process to practice physical therapy in Minnesota. I had to send my transcript from San Marcos University to the United States Credentialing Service Office in order to verify that I had the equivalent academic credits of someone who graduates from an accredited physical therapy program in the United States. There are many physical therapy programs around the world, and each country has their own minimum accreditation standards for their educational programs. Fortunately, my university credits exceeded the U.S. requirements. I also had to pass the TOEFL, is the test of English as a second language, and then I did 6 months of clinical practice under the supervision of a licensed physical therapist in Minnesota. Once I finished the clinical practice, I was allowed to sit to take the National Physical Therapy Licensure Exam. I knew that in order to practice in Minnesota, the minimum score that I needed to achieve on the exam had to be higher than the minimum that is set in many other states. I wanted to practice in Minnesota, and so I took the test knowing that I had to meet a higher minimum standard. I passed the exam. Only after passing the exam, I was allowed to practice physical therapy in Minnesota. I'm in favor of maintaining the licensure standards required to practice in Minnesota in order to protect the public safety and to maintain the professional level of practice in our state. Please know that I support foreign-trained physical therapists being licensed in our state as long as they comply with all the physical therapy licensure regulations. Again, I urge you to vote no on HF 575. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions? Okay, then we'll go to Ms. Picard.
Chairman Huntley and members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Picard. I'm a licensed physical therapist in the state of Minnesota, and I chair the Government Affairs Committee for the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association that represents about 1,200 licensed physical therapists in Minnesota. On behalf of the professional association, I would like to offer the following arguments in opposition to House File 575. First, this is a state's rights issue. The state of Minnesota has the right to license and to regulate professional practice in this state. And this bill is changing that. This bill is changing the requirements, the minimum requirements to practice physical therapy to the lowest requirement of now, as amended, the contiguous states to Minnesota. As the Physical Therapy Association, we believe that all physical therapists who practice in this state must meet the minimum required SOAR on the licensure exam. Second, we're being asked to lower the standards of healthcare here in Minnesota today. We've always had a high reputation for high-quality standard of healthcare throughout our state, and there's been a lot of good reasons for that, but one of them is standards in licensure. And today we're being asked to take a look at minimizing, changing the minimum standard of healthcare in this state. I ask you, does the state of Minnesota want to expand this notion of reciprocity to all licensed healthcare providers in this state? If it's good for the physical therapist, is it good for other licensed healthcare providers? Third, the bill talks about licensure without examination under two circumstances. And the circumstance that really is very concerning to us is on line 20 of the bill. And it reads, physical therapist has practiced physical therapy under the laws of another state. And it goes on to talk about the United States and so forth, but it's been amended to contiguous states. The problem is practiced physical therapy. No mention of licensure. And so this bill does not offer any provision for someone who has practiced in another state, lost their license under disciplinary action, and found their way to Minnesota because they have practiced, indeed, for the five of the last 7 years. They can practice. They can gain licensure in Minnesota and practice in this state. The Minnesota Board of Physical Therapy has been accused of limiting the number of physical therapists in this state, a closed shop, as it's been called. The fact is, there's been an increasing number of licensed physical therapists in this state in the last 5 years. It has increased 12.2%. For 2005, the board has licensed 3,425 physical therapists as compared to 5 years ago when it was 3,050. So the numbers are growing. We have the support of the Minnesota Provider Coalition, which is a broad coalition of medical providers of all specialties, including members of the medical societies in Minnesota. They voted unanimously to oppose this bill. I have a letter to that effect for your evidence. And their view has been that physical therapists, as with all providers that are licensed, have minimum standards for licensure, and they do not support changing them to meet the needs of an individual. So for these reasons, I urge you to vote no to House File 575. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Picard, so you're saying that if a person is disciplined or loses their license to practice in another state, that the interpretation is that they would regain licensure in effect by applying for a Minnesota license. Is that correct?
That's what the language reads.
Okay. I think that's a little bit concerning. Also, in looking at that, along with some of the other concerns, I think I would move to lay the bill over. But before we do that, I would just like to thank Representative Sharon for his work in this and for really going to bat for a very difficult situation for not just behalf of the constituent, but also on behalf of probably a lot of people who, when they see this process, see a lot of red tape that probably doesn't need to be there, and is making it very difficult for some folks to become licensed. And I think we need to really address that within our agencies and within your board so that we can have more licensed practice people, lowering the healthcare costs and improving access. So I just want to say thanks to Representative Sharon for that good work before I move to put this on the table.
It's been moved that this bill be tabled. Any discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair, before you take action, yeah, I'd like to still have a chance to say one.
Sure. Representative Sharon.
Actually, I would agree that we need to lay this on the table, but since I feel that my constituent might have been, there might have been some personal remarks, I'd like to respond to that. In terms of customer service, that my constituent couldn't get anyone to talk to until we got a hearing. Then she got all kinds of attention from the department. So just wanted to point that out, that she did try and try and try to get this discussed. So then she met a brick wall, and that's why she felt she needed to approach her legislator to help her with this.
Would you like her to come back up and testify?
Would you like to? Okay.
Sure. Mrs. Gridley.
It sounded like that I don't meet the requirements that are set forth. And to most points, I must say I do meet the requirements. The educational credentials that were talked about have been evaluated. I had my educational credentials evaluated before I entered this country, and I've been through this evaluation process, which was approved in all three states, or accepted in all three states, showed that I have more, almost double the educational requirements in professional education than is needed in the state. I'm falling short in general education, and according to the statutes here in Minnesota, I would have to go back to college to take arts, language, and so on. And I don't think that would make me a better therapist after all. I don't see how that fulfills the purpose of protecting the public from unqualified therapists. Also, about the traineeship, it is true that it could be waived, but I don't know if it will be, because the language says it has to be in a facility approved by the Minnesota Board. I do not know if that hospital I worked in Illinois is approved by the Minnesota Board. What is disturbing to me is that there's no discretion used at all in light of my experience, my work experience that I have done, that the law is applied to the letter, and yes, I fall short a point and a half in a score, but all the other requirements are there. And with my experience, I do not understand why the public has to be protected, why I'm a threat to the public here to work as a physical therapist. I'm also not aware of any state where you can practice physical therapy and not be licensed. And usually if a license is revoked, then I agree this person should not be licensed in the state either. But also licenses can be reinstated, but that should be a different process. And again, the reciprocity process works in other professions as well, and I don't see why I shouldn't be working for physical therapists again. The human body is the same regardless if I work in Wisconsin or here. And also, what the testimony implies is that other states are not protective of their constituents and their patients, that they allow anybody to work whoever wants to, but Minnesota has very high standards and they pride themselves off that. And I beg to differ.
Okay.
So if I can make a closing
statement. Representative Trump.
I think that what is disturbing to me today is I think that we need to have very high standards in all states. I think the scare tactic here of that, I'm not so sure that there are people dying in Wisconsin right now, as you might have been led to believe by testimony here today. And also, we allow portfolio review. We're talking very. We spent a lot of hours talking to this legislature about portfolio review for our teachers, recognizing the fact that the letter of the law always doesn't meet the needs of our students here in Minnesota. And certainly, if we have good qualified physical therapists, it would be good if we could get them some type of portfolio review, and that's why I'd like to lay this on the table, and so we may be able to work some of these things out.
Thank you, Representative Strong. Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, the motion is to table this bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. The bill is tabled. Okay, I think Representative Westrum is here. House File 464. And while they're coming up, I will move that House File 464 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, and committee members. This bill, I've got a constituent of mine who can do a superb job of explaining it. But this is an issue that I would like beg your indulgence to give thorough review and see if we can try to find a way to bridge the differences here that you'll hear about. This is some legislation that Representative Otremba had carried a couple years ago as well. It does come with controversy, but it really, I think, also is a fairness issue. And what we're asking is to allow hearing aid dispensers, specialists, to be able to fit and dispense hearing aids to persons on medical assistance like they do for private persons that pay for their hearing aids with their own money or have insurance. Insurance companies also will reimburse them, but government right now will not reimburse the procedures. And there's instances where we can save, where an audiologist may not exist in a community or may not offer the service of going to the nursing home to call on patients or clients, where my constituent will tell you in a practice others would have throughout the state where that is part of their practice, and they may offer that service and not have to bill the state for the cost of traveling if indeed they will go visit the resident or the customer at the nursing home or in a facility where they can't leave without us paying for transportation and those expenses. And so I would ask Mr. Wales to give you some brief background on this and ask you to pass this on to the committee, and really we need to try to get a resolution to this and get the parties earnestly discussing how they can settle this issue.
Thank you,
Representative. Mr. Wales,
introduce yourself.
Greg Wales, Gregory Wales, President of the Minnesota Hearing Healthcare Providers, which is a group of hearing instrument specialists, hearing aid dispensers, if you will, that are not audiologists primarily. We have some members who are audiologists, but I speak mostly for those hearing instrument dispensers in Minnesota who are certified by the Department of Health to dispense hearing aids, but who are not audiologists. We have had what we consider to be discrimination
For many years, you may be aware of recent years where our certification fees were $820 if we were not audiologists, and if we were audiologists, our certification fee to dispense hearing aids was $320, I believe. And this discrimination that Representative Westrom was describing by the Department of Human Services is regarding our ability to evaluate hearing for the purpose of selecting and fitting hearing aids on recipients of medical assistance. We currently are required to send our patients to an audiologist for a hearing evaluation and recommendation from an audiologist prior to fitting hearing aids. That's medical assistance recipients. Self-pay and policyholders that have insurance that cover hearing aids, we don't have that problem with. But with the patients who are recipients of state funding in Minnesota, we are not allowed to evaluate hearing for the purpose of the selecting and fitting of hearing aids. In the state of Illinois, for example, our counterparts, non-audiologist hearing instrument dispensers, are recognized as able to evaluate hearing for the purpose of selecting and fitting hearing aids, and they're reimbursed for it. So it isn't that this is a universal problem, although it is more a problem in the majority of the states. Another way to say it is Illinois is in the minority in this case, but it is being done in another state. I want you to be aware of that. I have a handout. I believe you may have received it. In handwriting on the top, it says rationale for House File 0464. There are more items in the bill than the reimbursement for and the recognition for non-audiologist hearing instrument dispensers to evaluate hearing for the purpose of selecting and fitting hearing aids. We have asked that the state of Minnesota use the licensure credential for hearing instrument dispensers in Minnesota. Minnesota is probably the only state that doesn't have licensure for hearing instrument dispensers. We have certification, that is our credential. And it does cause some hardship. Some laws and rules are written to provide and recognize reimbursement for licensed hearing instrument dispensers. And when the law says licensed hearing instrument dispenser, and we're a certified hearing instrument dispenser, and I'm speaking now having to do with not only the Medicaid and Medicare, but with insurance companies and just industry standards. They refer to licensed hearing instrument dispenser as a generic definition of a hearing instrument dispenser who is operating legally in the country, and we are not licensed hearing instrument dispensers. We're certified. So it may be a matter of semantics. It may have graver implications for some people. I don't know, but we're asking that the credential be licensure for hearing instrument dispensers in Minnesota in place of certified. We have also asked for a change in the continuing education unit hour studies that are required of hearing instrument dispensers. And that's at the bottom of the page. I'll read it out loud. It says, existing regulation requires 10 CEUs per year to maintain hearing instrument dispenser status. There is no requirement as to the specific subject matter covered in the CEUs. This bill requires that of the 10 CEUs required, a minimum of 2 CEUs cover medically related topics, and a minimum of 1 CEU cover government regulations. It also restricts the total number of CEUs provided by hearing instrument manufacturers who may be more inclined to be promoting their company or their product. It's understood that CEUs provided by manufacturers are valuable, but in many cases they are not generic in nature, and the term infomercial is often used when referring to manufacturer CEUs. That's not meant to insult manufacturers. We're looking out for the public good, and we would like to have education required that we think is in the public's best interest. That's one of the items that is in this bill. And for the sake of brevity, I guess I'll leave you with the paper that I distributed and offer to answer any questions if there are at this time.
Well, Mr. Wales, we have that copy, and if I get this right, what you're saying, this bill does, number one, it says that MA will pay if a hearing aid dispenser dispenses a hearing aid without having to refer the person to an audiologist, is that correct?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, we who are not audiologists,
yeah,
who are hearing instrument dispensers, may currently and do dispense hearing aids to people who are recipients of medical assistance funding. We can already do that. What we're not allowed to do, Mr. Chairman, is evaluate the person's hearing with an audiometric evaluation, determine the patient is a candidate for hearing aids, and recommend, in other words, choose or select the hearing aid fit on that patient. We have to send them elsewhere for that.
And Mr. Wales, was go from certified to licensure, and then the third was some change in the continuing education credits.
That is correct.
And are there any questions? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, based on this bill, why would we need audiologists?
Well, this...
Mr. Wales.
Excuse me. We need audiologists because audiology encompasses a lot more than evaluating hearing for the purpose of selecting and fitting hearing aids. Hearing instrument dispensing is regulated by the Department of Health through the Hearing Instrument Dispensing Certification System, which I would like to have changed to licensure system. Audiologists have many other tests that they administer that I'm not even familiar with, to be frank. Audiologists do generate most of their income today from dispensing hearing aids, but originally they were entity into themselves, an objective third party, if you will, that would evaluate hearing and then recommend the patients for hearing aid placement. It's a lucrative business, and they generate most of their revenue by retail sales of hearing aids now.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Emmer.
Thank you. One more. one more question. Under Section 27, What waivers are going to be necessary? What federal regulations are we worried about?
Greg Whale.
Mr. Whale.
I'm sorry, sir.
The only time that there might be a waiver is if the Department of Human Services would continue to maintain that the language of the laws, the strings that are attached to the federal funds that are used to purchase hearing aids for medical assistance recipients and used to pay for the evaluation, if those laws are interpreted by the Department of Human Services to say that only audiologists may perform the evaluation if there is going to be a use of those funds, then we are asking that the state request a waiver. The state of Illinois, as I said, have no problem with that, but in the Department of Human Services, their policy consultant has determined that there would be some conflict and that those funds cannot be used as I'm proposing here.
Representative Vincent.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley's. I couldn't resist. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Must be an inside joke.
It is an inside joke. Mr. Wales, quick question. First of all, is there a shortage of audiologists right now? From your
Wales.
Practicing audiology? Or are you talking about, is there a shortage of hearing instrument dispensers, be they audiologist or non-audiologist? There are exactly effective July 31st, I don't have that with me. Well, yes, I do. There are 385 certified hearing instrument dispensers in the state of Minnesota, effective January of 2005. Of those, 226 are audiologist dispensers. 159 are non-audiologist dispensers, such as I am.
Representative Vested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question, then. What, Representative Westrom, maybe this is to you, but have you asked for a fiscal note on this, or is there a fiscal note? To me, it sure seems like it would be with the MA patients that we're talking about here. So,
well, Representative Vested, I haven't requested a fiscal note, and perhaps something I should get done or do. The department, in discussions with Mr. Wales, has not been very receptive to even looking at this or viewing the federal law the same as Illinois has, and to my knowledge has no problems with their interpretation. So sometimes those who do the fiscal note can control the outcome, and that'd be my concern.
Well,
but I certainly could ask for one and see what.
Representative Westrom, we do have one, and it's a zero. So.
Okay. Zero savings, zero cost?
That would be my just that they said zero. So.
Yeah. But and it shouldn't cost anything other than add more people in that could receive benefit or compensation for the service. But then, Mr. Chair, I don't need to ask for one.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Wales? We have one other person, Janeline, I guess, Nickel. And then I'm going to ask somebody from the Department of Human Services to come up as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Janeline Nischel. He did very well. I am an audiologist down in Rochester, Minnesota, and on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Audiology, I'd like to express opposition to House File 464. And a couple of comments. In regards to Illinois, there is a minimum educational requirement of at least an associate's degree. Currently, the Minnesota statute, there is no minimum mandated educational requirement to obtain a hearing instrument dispenser certification. I'd also like to point out, in regards to changing the language from certification to licensure, I'd just like to remind the committee that it's my understanding that when a group seeks licensure, they'd normally go through the Council of Health Boards before coming to the legislature. What our main concern is on towards their desire to conduct and bill for unsupervised audiologic evaluations, which would require a waiver from the federal government. House File 464 will have a potentially harmful effect on Minnesotans with hearing loss. On average, 20% of hearing loss is caused by medically treatable disease of the ear, and if left unidentified, can cause deafness or even death. Physicians rely on accurate audiologic evaluations to make decisions regarding medical treatment and or surgical intervention. In addition, state and federal government health care programs recognize licensed audiologists as the qualified providers of audiologic services for Medicare and Medicaid recipients. Since the 1960s, audiologists have been required to hold a minimum of a master's degree in audiology, complete at least 350 hours of clinical practicum, pass a national examination, and complete a postgraduate supervised clinical fellowship year. Many audiologists currently hold a doctoral degree in audiology, and more are working towards it, including myself. There is no shortage of audiologists. Currently, there are over 340 licensed audiologists throughout greater Minnesota. Minnesota Medicaid reports that they have never received a complaint that program recipients could not access professional services from an audiologist in greater Minnesota. Non-audiologist hearing instrument dispensers are asking to perform and be reimbursed for evaluations they are not qualified or trained to perform. In addition to not having any minimal mandated educational requirements, not even a high school diploma, there is no mandated traineeship in this Minnesota statute either. We're not alone in believing the consumer is best protected when a diagnostic audiologic evaluation is conducted by a licensed audiologist with a master's or doctoral level degree. The federal government and the state of Minnesota have supported this level of consumer protection in the past. Previous administrations and the Minnesota Department of Human Services have been faced with this proposal, both agreeing that audiologists are uniquely qualified to perform audiologic evaluations. Neither body was willing to grant a federal waiver to allow non-audiologists to bill for these services. Please continue to support quality health care for Minnesotans by opposing House File 464. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Any questions for Ms. Michelle? Seeing if I could, if Ms. Cota could come up and...
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering if it would be helpful for, I forget your name.
Jeneline.
Mm-hmm. To identify what audiologists do differently than hearing aid dispensers. Perhaps she would know the answer, but I'm not sure.
Ms. Michelle.
I hope I know the answer to that. When we do a diagnostic evaluation, we do a lot more in-depth testing than just what's appropriate for hearing aids. We're looking at the entire audiological pathway. We're not just looking at what are the hearing levels and how well do they understand speech and quiet. That's only a very small part of the audiological system. We need to get a lot more in depth. There's a lot of electrophysiological tests that we can do, and when we can't just look at an audiogram and say you need a hearing aid, let's go. There are a lot of warning signs that when you are only trained to do pure tone, speech, airbone for the purpose of selling hearing aids, that you're not going to pick up, you're going to miss, and those are the potentially harmful things that if missed could lead to a lot more serious medically treatable things from a ear, nose, and throat specialist.
Representative Weston, do you have any other questions?
Well, I was looking in a broader sense, Mr. Chairman, because if it's the only thing they do, the state does license them both to do this. I understand statute, I think it's 153, Mr. Wales was telling me, sets out the standard and the practice that's supposed to be followed to do this, and they both do that. And I would just remind committee members, they do that, hearing aid dispensers and audiologists both do the same service in the private sector, and insurance reimbursed, it's the MA where we have kind of a division here of who can do the service and who can not do the service, and that's what we're simply trying to change. The state license or certifies both of them, and if in fact her testimony is that the federal government won't grant the waiver, then we aren't out anything passing this legislation, because someday they may grant the waiver, but if they won't now, then it won't happen anyways. But Illinois is doing this, as I understand it, and so there are some questions, and that's why this issue, I would hope we can keep flushing out, because there is a little division, as a lot of things go on here, that both sides have their own perspective, and I'd like to be able to see if we can get things worked out that it would be allow both my constituent and other constituents to have the chance at this business.
Representative Emmer.
Representative Westrom, I just want to read to you, because you haven't
had the opportunity to digest this, neither had we. The narrative to the fiscal note that says zero actually says, under assumption, since hearing instrument dispensers lack the medical expertise required and work independently and not under the direction of an audiologist, a federal waiver to allow MA coverage would not likely be granted. It goes on to talk about when the same bill was introduced in the last session, the Federal Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services was consulted and it indicated they would not grant a waiver to allow MA coverage for hearing instrument dispensers. And this will be important to you because I know what you're trying to accomplish. The next two sentences say the fiscal impact of this bill, based on that what I just read to you, is therefore zero. But the next sentence says, if a federal waiver were granted, there would be large systems and program medical assistance costs for the department. So I think there are bigger issues than just the one that you're addressing. And I don't know if that requires a response, but I thought you might want to know that.
Representative Westrom.
Well, briefly, Representative Emmers, and I'm not, where are you at, Representative Emmers? I can't hear through these.
I'm over here.
All right, that's what I thought it sounded like, but these systems are hard to detect where the voice is coming. That's the issue, and frankly, it gets to the issue that seems to be occurring in the department, but why it's all right to let private pay citizens pay for this service, why it's all right for insurance company to contract for this service, if there was this clamor of problems that the witness talked about because their certification on just dispensing and fitting hearing aids, Representative Emers, we're not talking about other in-depth hearing tests or hearing ear issues that audiologists have the training for. We're talking about the specific service of fitting and dispensing hearing aids and doing the tests for that fitting and dispensing. And so that's where the rubber meets the road, and it's been a tough nut to crack, and it seems that from the department on down, there seems to be a bias against doing what the private market is already doing in choosing who they do business with. And in my local town of Alexandria, there's an audiologist, Representative Emers, and there's my constituent who has Wales hearing aids. And the audiologist chooses not to make visits to the nursing home, where if it's a private pay, Mr. Wales will make that visit, and the state doesn't also have to pay for the transportation to bring that person to the audiologist if that's the only thing they need is the fitting and dispensing of the hearing aid. And so that's where this bill to me makes some sense. And sure, we have some work to do with the parties if we can get them to bargain, to start negotiating and work in good faith versus just protect some turf.
If we could hear from Kathleen Cota for a minute. She's from the Department of Human Services, and this is one of those incidences where the Department of Health actually does the licensing and the Department of Human Services does the paying for the MA. So, Ms. Cota, if you could just comment about what the department's position is on this and how it relates to the federal rules that you have to deal with.
My name is Kathleen Cota. I'm a manager with the Medical Assistance Medicaid Program for the Department of Human Services. Our position, bottom line, is dictated by the federal government, which has always had in the Code of Federal Regulations language which says that you need to be an audiologist. There is a few states that have apparently language in the state plan which allows them to have the hearing dispenser paid, and Illinois is one of those. The four neighboring states, for Minnesota, for example, have similar or stricter requirements in order to do an evaluation for a hearing aid. So it varies from state to state. We have discussed this, as was read earlier, with the Center for medical assistance, for Medicaid and Medicare. And the thing with waivers that's confusing is that there's a way to get a waiver for, like, the DD waiver, for example, where the government, the federal government, has set up a way that that certain providers can get certain sets of benefits that are different. But there's not a way to simply say to the federal government, waive some piece of law in the Medicaid law for us. So you can't really just ask for a waiver. What you do is you try to write a state plan that they'll approve. And their message to us thus far is that they won't approve it, that they believe you should be an audiologist in order for the feds to pay their 50% of the bill.
Representative Finstead.
Just a quick question then. Isn't there a, thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't there a fiscal note to write that plan? Just apply for the waiver?
Fiscal note.
Representative and Chair Huntley, no, our federal compliance people can write the state plan without needing any special. The fiscal note would come in two areas. One would be that we would have to enroll additional providers, and secondly, we'd have to do some systems work, so that would be the work of the department. It's hard to predict whether or not it would have an impact on utilization of hearing aids.
Any further questions for Ms. Cota? Okay, Representative Westrom, do you have any final comments?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Wales might have just a couple of responses to the, and I forget her name again, the audiologist.
Michelle. Ms. Michelle.
There you go.
Mr. Chair, Greg Wales.
Yeah, Mr. Wales.
The Food and Drug Administration regulates the sale of hearing aids and the dispensing of hearing aids and the evaluation of hearing on a federal level. And, of course, we're in compliance with that here. And there are a number of red flag conditions which we are trained and tested for by the Department of Health. And these red flag conditions are conditions where a layman, such as ourselves, is able to, through observation and the questionnaire and evaluating the results of our hearing evaluation, determine if the person must be referred for medical attention. And they're rather obvious, and the public is well protected with the existing red flag conditions as they are.
Any questions? Representative Westrom, do you have any final comment?
Mr. Chair, members, I think I've made my points, and I don't. I'd be up to the opinion if there's some things that you would suggest or ways we can get the groups to start really peeling the onion back here. I would be interested in your suggestions or guidance if you would have any. Again, if passing this bill would require a waiver according to the department, it seems to me the risk, there's no risk if the federal government's not going to grant it like they say if they won't, then this won't happen anyways, but at least give the hearing aid dispensers, give them a chance to pursue that and make it available for more customers out there to choose from them, as well as offer some services of going to the nursing homes and saving the state the dollars that it costs to transport these patients at times by passing this bill. But hopefully the department would work on applying for that waiver, and if it's not granted, the issue is at least not bottlenecked because of the state governments, and the federal government would be the place they'd have to work on this.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then I would renew my motion that House File 464 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed signify by saying no.
No.
The bill does not pass. Thank you, Representative Westrom and Mr. Wales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
You're up next, Mr. Abler, but I was wondering if 1840, there's someone was coming for mail, and I was wondering if he was here yet. Yeah, here he is. So why don't we start with House File 1840. It's the last one on the list, and if we get done in a hurry here, he can ride back with the audiologist from Rochester.
Thank you.
So, Representative Abler,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I need to move House File 1840 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, that's not a guaranteed success just because you moved it, I guess. I hope this one does better than the last bill I saw. This is has to do with physician's assistance and a technical problem with the way that they print out labels, and has to do also with the agreement. And since it's all came so far, I'll let him tell the whole story, and I'll give him some chance for some thunder, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rothwell.
Chairman Huntley and members of the subcommittee, my name is Walt Rothwell. I've practiced as a physician assistant at Mayo Clinic for over 15 years. I'm also a past president of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants, and I'm with you today on their behalf. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. PAs practice medicine with physician supervision as part of a medical team. The PA Practice Act allows a physician to delegate prescribing privileges to a PA under specific circumstances. More than 800 PAs are authorized to practice in Minnesota, and most of these individuals have some delegated prescriptive privileges. This bill proposes two small changes in the wording of 147A, which would ease some of the administrative burden associated with PA prescribing. I believe that these changes would not alter in any way the scope of practice of physician assistants or our relationship with supervising physicians. Section 1 listed in your overview is found on page 2, line 20, which removes the phrase "at least weekly" from the requirement for physician review of PA prescribing. We maintain that the new wording removes an arbitrary standard and allows each supervising physician the latitude to establish a procedure for review based on the individuals on the team and the nature of the practice. Section 2 listed in your overview is found on page 2, lines 30 through 32, which remove some requirements for the information that must be listed on each PA's prescription. We maintain that the requirement for a phone number is unfair because no other authorized prescriber is subject to this, and pharmacy law does not require it. We also feel that it's an unfair burden to require that the name of the supervising physician be printed on each prescription. The Board of Medical Practice website allows anyone to verify a PA's address and registration status, and 147A already requires that the board notify all Minnesota pharmacies of all PAs with delegated prescribing privileges, so the information is readily available. The requirement for listing a physician constitutes an unfair burden as practices convert to electronic prescribing, as it makes special customized programming necessary for PAs to meet the legal requirement. Since these features aren't necessary for physicians, nurse practitioners, or other prescribers, PAs can be left with an unreasonable burden in order to comply. We have discussed these changes in language with the Minnesota Medical Association, the Nurses Association, and the Pharmacist Association, who are all neutral on the changes. And I'd like to thank you again for this opportunity to explain the proposal and welcome any chance to provide further information.
Any questions for Mr. Rothwell? We open it to the audience. Representative Abler?
Sure. Let
is there anybody that wants to testify on this bill? Well, Mr. Abler, there was one person that wanted to, and she called me this morning. It happens to be a physician's assistant in Duluth that graduated from high school with my daughter. And the Duluth Clinic has exactly the same computer problem that the Mayo Clinic has, in that there just isn't space to put two names on the prescriptions. And so as we're moving into the electronic medicine, we will have problems like this. Any discussion? Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 1840 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was better than the last one.
And have a good trip back to Rochester.
Thank you.
Which one do you want to do next, Representative Abler?
Anything you like, Mr. Chair. There's a list on the schedule. It's all whatever you like. I don't have an opinion.
Okay, why don't we do House File 1935. I'll move that that be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. And I understand we have an amendment for that one. So why don't you, do you want to do the amendment first or do you want to describe the bill first?
Yeah, Representative Abler. There's a Deputy Old 5 amendment. Where did it go?
1935 is the bill.
Yeah, I'm just looking for my witness.
It's the audiologist.
Yeah. Are you going to check it out? Okay. What? It kind of gets you going again then, Mr. Chair. Oh, yeah, let's do the delete all this to get the bill in order. And that'd be the A050327. There were some small technical changes, and they decided just to redraft it with those technical changes.
I move that amendment. Is technical then, Mr. Representative Abler?
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. Now the bill is amended. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to save time, I'll just go right to my witness who can outline the details for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm and the rest of the committee. My name is Jocelyn Martin. I am an audiologist at the Mayo Clinic. Another one.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
but I'm here today representing the Minnesota Academy of Audiology. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Academy of Audiology and co-chair of the Governmental Affairs Committee. The House File 1935 proposes that audiologists be regulated for their hearing aid dispensing activities under their audiology license. Their audiology license alone rather than an audiology license plus hearing instrument dispenser certification. Dispensing hearing aids is, as you've heard already today, a major part of an audiologist's educational training and as well a major part of the audiologist's scope of practice under Minnesota audiology licensure law. House File 1935 streamlines regulations by reducing the need for audiologists to be duly regulated by the Department of Health while upholding the same level of consumer protection for Minnesotans. We are not the first state to consider this legislation. In 29 other states, at least 29 that we're aware of at this point, an audiologist needs only an audiology license to dispense hearing aids. This bill adds the consumer protection language related to hearing aid dispensing from the statute section 153A, that's the dispenser certification portion, to section 148, the audiology license. It adds language to the dispenser certification, the 153A, stating that individuals with an audiology license need not obtain that certification separately. It makes a change to the examination requirements. New audiology applicants would be required to take the practical exam. Audiologists already licensed in Minnesota or other states would not be required to take an exam. It's our understanding that this proposal should be cost neutral to the Department of Health. We understand that costs may in fact actually decrease because this should change the need for the Department of Health to review the audiology applications and continuing education units from 3 times in a 2-year period to 1 time in a 2-year period. And it's also our understanding that the department is working on a fiscal note. This bill will not impact non-audiologist hearing instrument dispensers. They will continue to function and work as they do today and continue to be regulated under the Department of Health. In putting together the language for this bill, the Academy of Audiology has been in close contact with the Department of Health. We've made every attempt to keep leadership in the loop along the way and have recently made some revisions to address the concerns that they had. We've also discussed this legislation with Minnesota Speech Language Hearing Minnesota Speech Language Hearing Association, who has let us know that they will not be opposing it as well. Thank you for your time. I have with me today a few other Minnesota Academy of Audiology audiologists who can help to answer any additional questions that might come up.
Okay, are there any questions for Ms. Martin? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Subdivision 7, it's blank. It says a surcharge of blank is added to the licensure fee. Is that, if it's for Representative Abler, that's fine. Did I miss that?
Just to listen it out.
I think this is a good place for me to ask Julie Trout to maybe give some comments because she works more closely on that part of life, her wording.
Would you come up and just identify yourself for the tape?
Hi, my name's Julie Perrault. I'm an audiologist from the Minnesota Academy of Audiology and here to answer that question the best I can. Truth is, we're not quite sure what the cost is. We know the cost will be fiscally neutral to the state of Minnesota, so whatever we're paying now will be just transferred over to our audiology license. Right now, we currently pay both. We pay $200 every 2 years to be licensed audiologists, and then we pay $350 every year to be certified hearing aid dispensers. Our intention is not to increase any costs. It's actually to reduce it. But we're not quite sure what the regulation will cost us at this point.
And Mr. Chair, this is going to go to the Finance Committee slowly, but by the time it's ever left there would be some firm agreement on that. So.
Well, Representative Abler and Representative Emmerich, my understanding, all these boards are self-supporting and there's no state money, and so they set the license fees, whatever it takes to cost to run that board and handle all the complaints. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then the other one is Subdivision 4. Why a misdemeanor, and how would it affect the license? Subdivision 4 says that if you violate any part of this section, you're guilty of a misdemeanor. And I'm just asking why a misdemeanor and how that would impact the license.
That really...
What page? What page?
7.
Page 7?
Lines 30 and 31.
Representative Abler or one of the witnesses.
That's the people that didn't do the right. Just try didn't write the bill, but very often that's kind of just the default penalty I know of.
Is there somebody here from the board? There was earlier, but Representative, Mr. Hindlemeyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Hindlemeyer from the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm involved in administration of the certification system for hearing instrument dispensers and the licensing system for speech-language pathologists and audiologists. The language, Representative Emmer, that you're asking about is being copied from Chapter 153A, which regulates hearing instrument dispensers. It's typical for occupational regulation to have either a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor penalty for violating the Practice Act. This does require the licensing agency to utilize local law enforcement to enforce the provision.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other part of the question was, say you have somebody who violates it, how does that impact their license?
Mr. Hindlemeyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, in most cases we're talking about people who are not certified or licensed, and so the provision is being utilized in the following manner. We are going to local police. They go to the business or look up the person who's alleged to be practicing without a credential and notify them that they're in violation of the law. Very often these people come to our attention because of some fraudulent activity related to dispensing of hearing instruments.
Okay, any further comments? We have one other person signed up to testify. Greg Wells.
Did he leave? That was the fellow that was here before.
Yeah, I know. well, he's not here now, I guess. So is there any other discussion on this bill from the members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one clarification question, because I did get quite a bit of calls and emails about this, and I just kind of want to be totally sure about this. We had pretty significant discussion about what the differences between dispensers and audiologists are, and I think we're pretty comfortable with that, and the differences in scope of practice, licensure, and continuing education. And I just want to be assured that if an audiologist is to assume the full scope of practice of a dispenser, that they are not missing out on any scope of practice expertise and or continuing education piece of that. So if I could just kind of be assured that all of one fits within the other for scope of practice, licensure, and continuing education, I'd have all the comfort I need.
Identify yourself again for the tape, please.
You bet. This is Jocelyn Martin. And actually, I'm not sure if this completely answers your question, so just ask me for clarification. But currently, audiologists do that. It depends on the practice setting, of course. At the clinic, at Mayo Clinic, I specifically do diagnostic testing as well as electrophysiologic testing, as well as balance function testing, as well as hearing instrument dispensing. All of those are things that I have to maintain competency in. Is that kind of what you're asking, or?
Representing.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically with, if you are not going to be licensed as a dispenser, are you losing out on any continuing education expertise or scope of practice expertise?
Oh, absolutely not. The audiology conferences and continuing education typically include hearing aid dispensing practices as well as all of those other things that I mentioned before.
Thank you.
The Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to be a simple question from a dumb farm kid from Sleepy Eye. Could this bill potentially put hearing aid dispensers out of business?
I don't expect that at all. Actually, it shouldn't. As I mentioned before, this is Jocelyn Martin again, Mr. Chair, Committee, Representative. The changes that we're suggesting should not make any changes in the way that non-audiologist hearing instrument dispensers do their job. That doesn't completely answer your question, I'm gathering.
Representative Finn.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm probably guilty of not reading this word for word, but my interpretation from what I've... Yeah, there is a lot of words here. big words. But it seems like we're expanding the scope of practice and we're allowing audiologists to be grandfathered into a different... It's probably not even different. It's probably something that you already do. But to a somewhat of a different territory. I mean, we were pretty hard on the hearing aid dispensers a few minutes ago, so I guess it's... To me, I mean, is this some sort of... all of these bills are turf battles and turf wars. But where's the middle ground here? I don't know. I mean, if you can answer anything of what I've just said, and I don't even know if I've asked a question. It's getting late in a moment.
Representative Finstead, right now audiologists can do audiology, and part of audiology is dispensing of hearing aids. Hearing aid dispensers can only dispense... hearing aids. They can't do a lot of what audiologists do. So their audiologists are well trained to do both parts of their practice. What this bill, I think, does is simply have the regulation of the audiologist hearing aid dispenser person, it doesn't both, under one board, and the non-audiologist hearing aid dispensers would be regulated by another board.
Mr. Chair.
Is that correct?
I think exactly. Then generally, the audiologists are either master's or doctorate level. Mm-hmm. And the hearing aid dispensers have to have a very low threshold of credential, which you've heard about before. So this just merely avoids the dual credentialing. They're already qualified. And so if the people, if the hearing aid dispensers can do this, then they're light years ahead of them. So.
Mr. Wales, did you want to testify in this bill?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Wales.
Probably not.
Chairman, Gregory Wales, Minnesota Hearing Health Care Providers. I wasn't here for the previous testimony or the reading, but I have some opinions, and I think that the general public would, and so should the committee members. There's definitely a bias against non-audiologist hearing instrument dispensers, and some of us are responsible for cost containment, and it seems that you're interested in some duplicity rather than streamlining. The consideration is actually to regulate one profession with two different administrative bodies, and that seems to me not to be cost effective. And generally, competition is economical. It's beneficial to the economy, and lack of competition creates higher prices. If one truly wanted to reduce the cost of administering audiologists, hearing instrument dispensing audiologists, non-hearing instrument dispensing audiologists, all of the disciplines would be put under one umbrella, not divided up further. And I would suggest that you consider that if you're interested in saving money and being efficient. This bill first came to my attention 3 days ago on Friday when I saw it appeared on the agenda for tonight's meeting. It didn't even have a number on it. I wasn't aware of the amendment until I came into this room this evening. I haven't had sufficient time to study the document. I haven't had any time to discuss it with my colleagues. I don't imagine that the Department of Health has had an opportunity to give input on it. I know as a member of the Hearing Instrument Dispenser Advisory Council, we have not discussed this bill. And it seems suspect to me. I feel discriminated against, and I would ask you to evaluate proposals and how they impact and benefit or don't benefit the general population. That's all I have to say. In case you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Wales? I don't see any. Mr. Hendelmeyer, does the Department of Health have a position?
Mr. Chair, Tom Hendelmeyer with the Minnesota Department of Health. The department does not have a position on the bill. We have some concerns, one of which Mr. Wales just mentioned, which is that we have advisory councils that have not had an opportunity to provide the department with review and comment. So though I have provided some concerns that I have that have been taken into account by the proponents of the bill, I can't say that I've been in a position to provide all the comments that might be made about the bill. I expect that within the next month I will have the information I need from the advisory councils to say what the department's position on the bill might be.
Any questions for Mr. Hendelmeyer? Thank you. Representative Abler, do you want to give it your final shot here?
How are we doing, Mr. Chair? Should I talk long about health, or is it just... here's the deal. There's we've talked forever about dual oversight in the past. We talked about nursing homes inspected by the federal and the state inspectors. We talked about dual credentialing and duplication of oversight. this is one instance when the dual oversight doesn't do any good. It just actually causes more burden on the at least on the practitioners to no benefit. And that's the point of the bill, and it removes, they already have master's and doctoral level credentials. They carry malpractice, they practice in group settings, they have a high ethic in their profession, and this is actually a pretty small part. So, hope to see it that way, and I think I'll stop now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions? Then I'll renew my motion that House File 1935 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Abel. You also have the next one.
What one would you like?
How about 1865? I'll move House File 1865 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee.
And Mr. Chair, it's too long. I'd like to offer the Amendment. Would you please offer Amendment A1 and make it a little bit shorter, if you will? It'll reduce your
time. I would offer Amendment A1, and would you want us to vote on that first to get the bill into the form you wanted, or do you want to discuss A1?
The people who don't want to testify would like to have offer A1 right away. It's actually a single word, Mr. Chair, and has to do with dental hygienists, and it's actually very controversial. If you wanted to be here another hour discussing the merits of one word, no, so the agreement is for now we're going to take that out, and they can work on that in rules and in the future. So
I'll just take dental hygienists out of
that's
the bill.
Correct.
And any discussion of that? All those in favor of the Amendment A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Abler, the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a representative of the dental board who will save us time and give us her survey of the bill.
Hi, my name is Kathy Johnson from the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and I believe you have an overview of our bill of 1865 in front of you. Section 1 is merely clarification. Section 2 is something we've needed to change to reflect changes that we made in our rules last year. And Section 3 is the fees, and in order to comply with requirement of putting fees into statutes, we've listed those there, and that continues on the other side, and that is all we have. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Johnson? Seeing none, Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, with that change in the amendment, it becomes actually a housekeeping bill. Before it was more of a house cleaning bill.
Okay, I'll renew my motion that House File 1865 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That one passes. And Representative Huntley is next on the list.
Is he? Okay.
And I would move House File 1161 that it be recommended to pass sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. And Mr. Hindelmeyer from the Department of Health is here. This is pretty much a housekeeping bill. Involves, I think, three different boards, which he can explain to you. But I would say that two of the boards didn't think we were tough enough partners at one board, and so they, on page 2, lines 8, it says 12 months, and I would move to change that to 6 months. And also on line 36, page 2, it says 12 months, and the board would prefer that, or the association would prefer that be 6 months. So I'd make that amendment to the bill. Any discussion of the amendment? Yeah, that's line 8 on page 2 and line 36 on page 2. Four. Yeah. Any discussion of that amendment? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Mr. Hendelmeyer wanted to describe my bill.
Mr. Chair and members, Tom Hendelmeyer, Minnesota Department of Health. This bill concerns four occupations. There are four sections, one section for each of the occupations. First occupation is speech language pathology and audiology licensing. The second occupation is occupational therapy licensing system. The third occupation is the alcohol and drug counselor licensing occupation. And the fourth is hearing instrument dispensing. Each section does exactly the same thing, though some of the particulars in terms of dollar amounts and, as just amended, the time periods are slightly different in respect to the desires of the respective professional associations for each of the occupations. In each section, there is a subdivision that first establishes a penalty fee for practicing without a license during a lapsed period. This occurs when you have a license and you are scheduled to renew. You go past the renewal period. Beyond the period of time which you can renew it with a late fee, past the expiration date of the license, actually, and you continue working. This happens with some regularity, and our current laws require us to do an investigation of each situation and determine penalties on the basis of the economic advantage gained by the individual. So what we are wanting to do or trying to do in this bill is change the process by which we hold such individuals accountable for a lapse in continuing to practice. The second subdivision in each section addresses individuals who fail to provide a continuing education, who fail to apply for a license after they have already been working for a while. And this essentially happens in situations where people are either unaware of the licensing requirement or ignore the licensing requirement, and we are again in the same situation of having to hold them accountable on a case-by-case basis, and we are trying to just establish a more efficient process. Individuals would have advance notice of what such a penalty would be in that situation and would be expected to pay it as part of the license application fee. The third paragraph in each section then addresses continuing education. Each one of these occupations has continuing education requirements, a certain number of credit hours that are required over a time period. Some individuals miss filing their reports within the correct time period. Some individuals fail to get the correct amount of continuing education credits. And so what this provision does is establish exactly what the penalty is for failure to comply exactly. The fourth paragraph in each section makes these kinds of violations non-disciplinary actions. There is some unfairness in what we might consider to be technical violations of the statute, resulting in a mark, a black mark, if you will, on a person's licensing record that would require a report of a disciplinary action for one of these violations. We don't view these as serious or at all egregious in comparison to complaints or disciplinary action that's taken regarding competency to practice. And so we are wanting to distinguish between these types of violations based on their severity. And the fourth paragraph in each section would make it a non-disciplinary action. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them at this point.
Mr. Hendelmeyer, that would mean that if somebody was 2 months behind in his three applications for his license, that the board would not have to have a hearing on this, that the department would simply make sure that the individual
correct
filed his license. reapplication?
That's correct. It would essentially establish the administrative penalty for the violation.
And so then he would not have a on his record that that there was had been a discipline.
It would be not. It would be characterized as a non-disciplinary action. It would be characterized as a penalty and a fee paid and a fine paid, essentially.
Any questions for Mr. Handelmeyer? No, I don't see any, so I'll remove my motion that House File 1161 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you, Mr. Handelmeyer. Representative Abler, I would move House File 1294 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Abler, and I think there's an amendment here.
I think there's two. Amendments. There's one that's one's technical and one is not by any means technical. And so if, and it's actually the first one, if you take up Amendment A1, first of all, that's the simplest one.
I would move Amendment A1.
And Mr. Chair, this merely clarifies that a Christian Science practitioner is also part of the clergy. And if you want their testimony about that, I think people are pretty well apprised that they exist in that status. And the board who's here, you don't mind. So it's clarifying, and if you want to ask questions about it, you can.
Don't we do this for practically everything? For Christian Science?
That's right, Mr. Chair. So it seemed appropriate to let them be part of this.
Okay, so that's A1. Any questions about the Amendment A1? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. So, Representative Abler, you have another amendment.
Mr. Chair, let's take up the bill, and then we'll take up the amendment after we've heard the bill. If it's all you, I've got
Representative Abler
from the board here who are happy to discuss in detail the matter before you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Merriman. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the bill. With me is Kate Zacherpate, the Assistant Director of the Board. We are passing out a summary of the bill, which will highlight some of the substantive changes that are in the bill. As you can see from the summary that was prepared by House Research, most of the bill is a simple recodification of existing statute and rules. The bill is an outgrowth of an effort that the board has undertaken over a period of time of at least a year, working closely with social work associations to go through the entire Social Work Act and also all of the social work rules in an effort to streamline the process, make the requirements simpler, more clear, and less bureaucratic. And as part of that process, what we've tried to do is to integrate into the statute all of our rules. So if you pass this piece of legislation, the Board of Social Work will no longer have any rules. They'll all be part of statute. And the reason for that is several. For one thing, it makes the requirements much easier to understand because you're just looking at the requirements all in one place, namely the statutes. Whereas now, with the rules, you have to go back and forth between the statutes and the rules in order to try to understand what the requirements are. And also it makes the board more accountable to the legislature because under the proposal, all of the requirements would be established by the legislature through statute. So most of the proposal that you have before you is simply that, and that is why the bill is so long, because it incorporates all of the statutory provisions and all of the rules provisions that the board has. It's not a simple housekeeping bill, however, because there are some substantive changes, and that is in the document that I passed out, the two-page summary. I'm not going to go through all of those substantive changes because I think it would take more time than it's probably worth. However, we will certainly be happy to answer any questions that you have. I think they're explained there fairly easily. I will talk a little bit about the process and the goals of the changes. As I mentioned, we worked very closely with the associations in developing the proposal. So as far as we know, All of the changes that we're proposing are non-controversial. We have worked with representatives of the various associations who represent social workers very closely. We've publicized the proposal on our website. We've also met with members of the social work profession in conferences. We've also mailed out information on the proposal to all of the individuals who we license. So we've made a significant effort to publicize what's in the proposal and to take out anything that might be controversial. So like I say, as far as we know, everything in there is non-controversial. And the bill is a part of a larger effort on the part of the Board of Social Work to simplify our requirements in order to operate more efficiently and cost effectively, to strengthen public protection, to make our requirements easier to understand, to promote customer service, and to promote cultural diversity. So those are the one provision that I will highlight is one that has to do with it's on the second page of your handout, provisions to promote cultural diversity, and that's the foreign-born English as a second language provision. And I highlight that one because the legislature did ask the board to make a report to the legislature, which we did do last fall, and the legislature had established a requirement a couple of years ago that the board offer an alternative method of licensure for social workers who or for applicants who speak English as a second language or who are foreign born, and also asked the board to conduct a study of those individuals to see if there was any bias in the national examination that had previously been required of all applicants. The board did conduct that study. The legislature had required that the study be conducted by an independent researcher but commissioned by the board. So we received the report from the independent researcher. The independent researcher did find that there were some disparities in people's ability to pass the licensure examination based on race and ethnicity and foreign-born status. And the board was also supposed to make recommendations to the legislature, but because it's a very complex subject, we were unable to arrive at a conclusion as to whether or not there should be changes in the existing requirements. So instead, what is proposed in this legislation is that the program be extended another 2 years. Under the original legislation enacted by the legislature, the program would be sunsetted at the end of this fiscal year, June 30th. But because we have not arrived at final conclusions on what recommendations we would like to make to the legislature, we're asking for another 2 years of time to study the issue in more detail so that we have more confidence in recommendations that we would make to the legislature. So we will bring that back to the legislature when we are ready to do that. So that, as I say, is pretty much a very brief overview of what's in the bill. Because it's non-controversial, as far as we know, I wasn't going to go into detail on the various substantive provisions that are in the bill, but of course, if you have questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you say simplify. I did read this. It's anything but simple, and it's long and it's boring.
That's right, you're a lawyer.
First, I have two questions. One that you just raised for me, but I'll go to the one I was going to ask and then come back to that. On page 26, the amendment that I didn't vote for, it says members of the clergy, and then you the amendment was to add and Christian Science practitioners. Why?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would prefer to defer that question to the people who initiated the amendment. Mr. Chair, I offered the amendment at the request of the fellow who left. If he should have stayed to see his work done. anyway, I think it was unclear. I don't have any connection at all to Christian Science practitioners, and I don't even know just what they do specifically different than some other ones. But I think they sense a need to be allow it into the niche of clergy, because they have a very, I can't even describe much more than that, but that's, that they felt that they needed that to clarify that they were included in the group of clergy.
They don't use the word clergy in their religion, is my understanding, and so that they just call themselves practitioners. And for the rest of us in the world, we would think they were clergy for what they do, but that's not how they define themselves. And so this simply lets them be treated like clergy in other religions.
Well, I guess if that's the answer, that's the answer. The other one that Mr. Chairman, the other question I had related to this discussion about page 2, I thought you said, and the study that was done. Am I looking in the wrong place? Because it was such stimulating reading. I think I must have missed something. It didn't have any pictures. That was a problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would be happy to add pictures if that were allowed by
That would help. That would help.
I was referring, though, to the page 2 of the summary, not to the bill.
Oh.
So if you look at the middle of the page of the summary, there's a reference to the...
Where is it in the bill? I'm sorry.
The bill, in the bill, it's actually in several places because the language applies to... we have 4 different levels of licensure, and you'll find the same language in the provisions that relate to each licensing level. But let me see if I can find one for you.
Mr. Chair, while I was looking for that, if I may, the whole topic of allowing this alternative licensure for foreign-born folks was one of the successes, I think, of our group legislative career. It was there's a very real need, especially in some of the newer populations to the state, and especially the Hmong. I don't think they had a written language, I don't think, when they got here. And so giving written tests was a little challenging. And so, but they had very great need for this service in their group. And so the challenge was to not let them serve, even though they were qualified in their home country and had credentials that would have been just fine, even by many of our standards, but certainly by theirs, or let this group go and serve. And if you're aware, the Hmong group in particular has a very high challenge with, many of their, just because they're very clannish and that's gone, and so they have a lot of teen issues and family issues, and they very much need to be this help in their families. And so I don't know how many have been licensed under that alternative program, but it's been a tremendous success, and it's been a very big help to that community. So.
If I could just say, it was a very controversial issue, and the question in my mind was, on the one hand, you might say you're lowering the standards for this group of people, and practically everyone believes that every group ought to have the same high standard providers, but there's definitely a language problem in passing the exams, and so there's some attempt to try to work around those problems. And it's obviously they haven't been able to come up with a good solution in 2 years, and hopefully in another 2 years they will.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, the language, if you want to look at the actual language in the bill, like I say, it's in several places, but if you look at the language on page 14, lines 13 through 25, that would be the language. Now, the proposal that you see in front of you does not change the existing language, except changing the date that the program would expire, and that language is on line 25. So currently the language reads, this paragraph expires August 1st, 2005. We're simply changing that so it reads 2007 to give us those 2 extra years to try to, as Representative Huntley mentions, it's a complicated area, so we felt we needed some more time to look at the issues.
Representative
Hammer. So when you say a study, you're just taking the information generated from this type of language in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've done a study already at the direction of the legislature to determine if there are disparities.
Last one.
Mr. Hammer.
It was just pointed out to me that apparently the board is immune from criminal prosecution. Why is that?
Maybe they carry the same card that we do.
I don't think that makes us totally immune.
Mr.
Chair, representative members of the committee, that's there to protect. I think all public officials have that kind of protection. It's in order to protect you in the performance of your public duties. It doesn't mean that if you go out and commit a crime that is unconnected with your public duties, you're not responsible for that. Of course, you are. But would you be able to refer me to the specific language that you're talking about?
It says section 148D.040, section 9.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a page number on that? I'm sorry.
I think we're looking. And while they're looking, Mr. Chairman, the page 7, I guess, is where it is. I can understand civil immunity, I think. I see that more, but criminal immunity from criminal prosecution.
Representative Thiessen, you want to jump in on this one?
I think, I mean, if the idea is that this is a governmental immunity, that would be civil, not, as I understand it, not criminal. But I don't know if there's other reasons for that. I don't really want to jump in the middle of it. So, but I mean,
you just did.
Mr. Chair, I believe it to be standard for all the boards. So we could fix them all at once.
Okay. You got an amendment? I'm sorry.
Kendall Meyer, is this, do you know if this is standard? I have no idea. He doesn't know either. Well, Representative Abler, you ought to check into that before it gets to the next committee.
Mr. Chair, well, I'll check on that. Just for the comfort of the committee, this is not new language.
You got that far.
This is a recodification of the existing statutes and rules, and except what they've told you about, it's all new language, looks like, but it's just actually being moved and recodified. And President Emmer, just for the sake of people who actually read this stuff and look for things, this is easier than it was before. So this is an improvement.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, to the point you just made then, so this is, there is no new language in this bill?
That's not true. What the Mr. Representative said, what they outline in their summary is the bulk of the text is not, but the outline, the changes they outline to you and in the summary that they passed out are new. So the
Representative said it's also a combination of stuff that was in rules plus what was
right
in the statute.
Right, I understand
so
that.
So all the rules stuff would be new.
I looked, Mr. Chair, and just explain this to me quick, if you could. Increase in fees, the fees that were in rule. Explain this to me quick, if you could. Increase in fees, the fees that were in rule are being shifted over to this, correct or not?
That's the best next amendment we'll talk about. Fees.
Okay.
Do you want to do the amendment now, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Aver. What's the number on the amendment?
AO504159.
I move the 0519 amendment. 0159.
And Mr. Chair, this is there's a difference of opinions about how that these different boards are allowed to run themselves. You've heard already that there's a thing called a special revenue fund that every board has their own little pot of money, and their job is to manage it to collect as much as they need and no more and no less. And every year there's a biennial appropriation and that they actually make up their own. And they make up their own fees. They decide what they're going to pay themselves, and they have a little, not nearly enough, I don't suppose they'd say. But anyway, they pay themselves a normal number. They give per diem to the board members, et cetera, and they figure out their costs for discipline, et cetera. And that's all part of the special revenue fund, which is why when you see all these fiscal notes on these board bills, there's no state fiscal note because there's nothing to the state. It's all out of the special revenue fund. The alcohol and drug group that you're going to hear from next, part of the problem is they had a big deficit. And I think it's a five-year repayment plan that they had to do, and that's why the fees are so high in alcohol and drugs, and that's why the concern of who has to pay fees and who does not. In the past, this board has had a very challenged, it has a long and tortured history of fees. And if you were here a few years ago, you would have got a letter from the National Board, the National Association of Social Workers, wondering why they had to pay, was it $400 or more? To be social workers, And they, in many cases, didn't make a lot more than in the 20s, I think, in some of the jobs they had. And so it was a very real problem. The Board of Social Work has been dutiful in the past several years and gotten their finances in order. And they were hoping to lower their fees to reflect that success. This is where the, just for disclosure, this is an amendment I had drafted at my request based upon private conversations with people about what the fees should have been. There is the governor has in his work has frozen some of these fees and not allowed them to lower them and try to capture some revenue. And I find that to be a problem with this board in particular. And so I'm bringing forward amendments that would allow them to have their proper fees and then manage them within their own revenue targets. So that's the full disclosure, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative, these are all reductions?
And the board can testify the specifics about it.
No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, why do we want to encourage boards to expend funds in excess of anticipated revenues? Before you answer it, I'll just add the rest of it. I see what you're trying to accomplish because you're saying by using the accumulated surplus, but it doesn't really limit it. It doesn't say that they can't spend funds in excess of anticipated revenues if they don't have a surplus. So my question is, why do we want to encourage expending funds in excess of the anticipated revenues?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler,
there's a surplus in their fund, and so they have to, they'll have to, their expenses haven't dropped, but the revenues are ahead of expenses. And so if they lower their income by reducing their fees, they'll need to tap into that surplus so that they can have the lower fees and the lower income. And so that's what their amendment does. Allows them to lower their fees.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I understand, but you see, I don't think your amendment closes the door. Your amendment says may expend funds in excess of anticipated revenues, and then you do reference that it would come from accumulated surplus, but it doesn't say in the event there is no accumulated surplus, you can't expend funds in excess of the anticipated revenues.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
and they have to do a biennial budget, and so these are rejuggled every 2 years, and they, if they have a deficit, they can go out a couple of years, and surplus needs to be able to lower. And so these are fee-based, and so if this board will be back in 2 years with the budget, and 2 years after that, and 2 years after that, and it'll be part of the governor's budget. Does that help? So it's a two-year deal.
Representative Emmer, if
so then
sometimes they have more complaints, and they have to have more hearings than they had anticipated, and that's where most of the money actually goes. Any other questions? We haven't voted on the amendment yet, have we?
No, Mr. Chair.
Then I'd renew my motion for Amendment 0159. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Amendment passes. Representative Abler.
We're done talking, Mr. Chair, if you want
to. Anybody from the audience wish to comment on this bill? Well, we got one. If you please introduce yourself for the tape.
Okay, why don't you?
My name is Pam Lunenberg, and I'm the staff person and coordinator of the Minnesota Coalition of Licensed Social Workers, and it's a group of the seven major professional associations in the state, including NASW, the largest group. And I just want to say that we were very, very happy with the board's process in revising their statute. They called on that as different types of expertise was needed. They called on the association members to provide it. We looked over it in detail, and we think it's a really good bill and are happy to have it passed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No. Anybody else in the audience? Being none, then I would renew my motion that House File 1294, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Health, Policy, and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I vote yes.
So that one passed. Next is a series of three bills, Abler, Larson, and Abler. And it's my understanding, Representative Abler, that you intend to tuck these all into the first one. Is that correct?
Into 11-12. And Mr. Right. Chair, I don't know the status of the Larson project, and I think...
Mr. Chair, yes. Just talk to Representative Larson. He's comfortable with Representative Abler's bill.
Okay.
So he won't be here.
Okay, then I would move House File 11-12 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health and Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Abler.
Consider the DE-3 amendment.
And I would move the DE-3 amendment to House File 11-12. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, this is a product of a... Maybe someone should come tell us about this. Maybe the issue, there are a lot of issues. We put a... Can I say gun to the head? That's an image. We got people together, and we gave them reason to talk. And they were all very happy to sit down and have a nice long chat. We talked for an hour, and that wasn't enough. And they went off in the hallway, and then they spent some other time. And what this is, I think everybody kind of gave a little bit and pushed a little bit. And the challenge, members, with Minnesotans like high standard, orderly, you know, highly credentialed professionals. And sometimes when you try to bring in a new group, they don't always mix as well. You saw that. Sometimes the groups are too far apart. You saw that with the audiologists and the hearing aid dispensers. They're just quite a different strata. As other groups move closer to the stratas, you both get some competition and also some later acceptance. And I think that these groups, in 5 years from now, will be far less of the challenges that we see now. So with that introduction, I'll let maybe Ms. Molson.
Introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Megan Mose with the county. Would you like me to summarize the amendment, Mr. Chair? Okay. Well, I don't think I'll go section by section, Mr. Chair, unless members want that. I guess I'd just say the amendment does three main things. The first is, lengthening for another year the transition period for hospital, city, county, and state agency drug and alcohol counselors. And then it reinstitutes some old grandfathering or grandparenting criteria that were used initially. It kind of reopens it up so more people will have an opportunity to become licensed. And then on page 4, in subdivision 1 at the top of the page, we really view this section as clarifying kind of the current practice of the health department in administering this license, just clarifying that social workers employed by city, county, or state agencies, as well as Rule 25 assessors and those providing case management services under Rule 25, the license would not apply to those individuals.
That's it, Mr. Chair. That's okay. Is there any questions for Representative Abler? So you've defined what these people work for the counties and the cities do, and is that precise enough so that you can distinguish between those and those that are licensed and those that aren't licensed?
Mr. Chair, we carved out perpetually people who are doing assessments and Rule 25. They're working with that. If you're doing alcohol and drug counseling, you've got to be licensed sooner or later. Either you can get it in part of the grandfather process, or you'll have until 2007 to pull it together. If you're a social worker or a licensed social worker, if you're a licensed social worker, you're exempt from that. If you're a social worker working for a county or a city or the state, you're also exempt. But if you're just doing the work, it looks like you're an alcohol and drug counselor, then you're an alcohol and drug counselor. It was kind of, I think, is that it, right? And so the attempt is to give a credential. If you're really doing the work of sitting down, doing the face-to-face and in treatment, then you should be certified in that.
That's and does that...
You got another witness here.
Yeah, you said city, counties. Does that include also school boards then? We had some testimony from a teacher or school social worker.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Megan Mose again. As I understand it, the school personnel would still be allowed to transition in with the rest of the public employees, but they would not be exempt from licensure under this bill.
Mr. Chair, move this toward the high standards we all kind of like, but sometimes it's hard to bring the tails along with the people that have said, you know, in this issue, we still have not resolved it. An unresolved issue, which you may hear from witness or two, is the fees of the people who are being grandfathered in or having the license in the regional treatment centers in particular. And they amount to $300 or something a year. Or is it a binding?
$200
a year. And that's an open issue, which there may be some way to resolve that, although once, if you waive the fees, then you have the people who are paying the fees unhappy because you have a smaller pool to really divide the fees amongst. And if they have to pay them, they haven't got the money. So this would be a finance question, I think, in the next committee. We'll try to find some great way to figure it out. So,
any questions for these witnesses that are up here right now? I think we're going to have a few more.
My name is Bob Nelson from the March Association. We have worked with Megan and Representative Abler to come to an agreement that we think we can deal with. We still have concerns about providing service or assessments by qualified people. That is not to say that people who are currently doing them in the counties are not, but we still have that concern. But this is a good compromise.
Could you state your name again for us?
My name is Bob Nelson. I'm a representative of the Minnesota Association for Resources, Recovery, and Chemical Health, the March Association.
Thank you. There's other folks in the audience that would like to comment.
Thanks.
Please state your name for the table.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark Mackey, representing AFSCME Council 6. Our position has been, as we've, I think as some of you know, to go for full exemption of city, county, and state employees. This particular amendment, the bill as amended, takes it quite a big step forward, particularly for the county workers, some of the state employees. We do have a bunch of folks that work in the regional treatment centers, as Representative Abler alluded to, who, as I look this over, are not affected, would still be licensed. And as you know from that extensive testimony we had last Wednesday, that they have great concern over the very high level of the fees. So we again would say, step in the right direction, we'd still prefer full exemption. Thank you.
Mr. Bergson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Bergson from MAP, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, statewide labor union representing roughly 11,000 state employees. One of the nice things about going after Mr. McPhee is that we basically have the same position. But I'd like to add one caveat that he briefly touched on. With the increase in fees and no increase in pay, since our folks are under a pay freeze for the last 2 years, and potentially another one coming up for the next 2 years, all of these fees and education costs and continuing education costs are putting our folks at a distinct disadvantage when it comes to making a living. They're having a tough time, and this is just another layer of fees that they have to come up with out of their own pocket, and education dollars that they have to come up with out of their own pocket that is starting to have an effect on their ability to make a living. So that's basically our position.
Any questions for okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Huber.
It's the bill, the next bill, this is House Bill 637. One of the amendments has a lot to the transition to the Alcohol Drug Council. It's the same board. And maybe it'd be your, if you could, I didn't ask you what this for, but if it'd be your pleasure, we could incorporate this bill into 637, and it would be, I think, a good match to keep the one board topics together. So you can think about that if you want.
Let me think about how we do that.
Yeah, and this could be a matter of amending the DE3 amendment onto House Bill 637, and they would page in line it somehow or other. So you can keep that in mind if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can
On this issue of the fees, so the deal is currently they're not licensed, so they don't have to pay any fees, and the concern is that they'd have to become licensed and so start paying fees. Is that the gist of this?
That's correct. And the catch 22 is if you don't make them pay the fees, which, well, I wouldn't just do that, but then the next group coming up will pay, they haven't got the money to run their board. I'm going to have to raise the fees on the people who are currently paying fees.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as they were, the current law would be their license as of 2006 when the fees would start. This pushes out one more year, so it buys them a year. But if we would then make sure that the DHS would pay their fees for them, they'd have a fiscal note and come out of the state. So that's the problem.
Good luck, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this legislation passed last year. So the policy of actually, or 2 years ago, the policy of actually moving to a license, that's been through the legislature and passed.
That's 2003. And so we're pushing the sunset out one more year, or the grandfather period one more year, so maybe a big windfall comes in.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. question for Ms. Schill, if she'd be willing to ask. We just heard some testimony about the increase in fees and the different fiscal implications. Do we have a fiscal note on this, or are there any fiscal information that you can fill us in on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I haven't seen this amendment until just now. And so I wouldn't be able to respond, but if I were doing a fiscal note, the first thing I would ask is how many people would this involve to get an idea of the sphere of the impact. And then, of course, if they were all public employees, it would have fiscal impacts for state agencies as well as local government. So that's what I could offer at this time.
Where what I'm thinking is if we pass this the way I made the motion, you could combine them in the full committee.
If you like.
With 637.
Thank you.
So any further discussion of this bill? I renew my motion that 1294 be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee as amended. 1294. Actually, I thought we'd be here at midnight, but we may get done earlier, but I'm already starting to slip here. I'll do that again. I would move House File 1112, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Make it. I'll rule it a pass.
And Mr. Chair, the fiscal concerns can be handled in finance, and there'll be a discussion about that there.
Okay, let's. I'll now move House File 637 that it be recommended to pass, sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, there's some amendments that. I have two written amendments and then one oral one, and then we'll present the bill for it. They'll get the bill in the order it should be given. First, Mr. Chair, if we can, do you have an A2 amendment in front of you, Mr. Chair?
Yes. 637 A2 amendment, I would move that, Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, this will save a whole lot of debate. If you remember the debate we had last time on the alcoholic drug, you'd have a similar group, actually different names after their different initials, with some of the same discussion points. And not that the ideas that are taken out of the bill are ideas that aren't good ideas, but they're not ready for prime time today, and they need to be worked through with the various groups. And so this deletes some of the language about takes away some of the board flexibility. It takes away some of the grandfathering and some of the flexibility that many people thought was a little bit too excessive for the board at this point in time. It may yet come up by the time we just get through conference. But at least they can work through those differences. So that I would suggest we adopt A2 right now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any discussion of the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You have another amendment?
I have an oral amendment, Mr.
Chairman. Oh, oral one?
In the same vein, in Section 10, and again, it has to do all these licensing things, and dentists, it's like who can put their fingers where and what mouth and what thing they can pick up and what can they do with it. And in this, it's like who can do what tests and who's, and it's very important. And the differences are tedious, but they're very important and they're meaningful based upon what you're credentialed to do and what your competencies are, and we and you all get to decide this. Anyway, in the idea of testing, who can do testing and who can do assessments? Anyway, for today, we're going to do assessments. And so in Section 10, page 11, and if it goes into page 12, wherever you see the word test, if you can make it say assessment tool. And it happens in several places in that paragraph. And it seems technical, but I think it's important to the groups involved in this. And this will be discussed later, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I would move that amendment and ask the staff to, in that section, replace test with assessment tool.
It's in numerous places, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, Representative Abler, do you have another one?
I should have brought cookies, Mr. Chair. If you would move the AO5-0322 amendment, please.
Representative Dean.
Representative, is there any statutory language for the difference between a test and an assessment tool?
I'm not sure if they're still here.
If we're changing the law, what that means?
Well, the subtlety is this. If I, with all respect to the audiologists and hearing aid dispensers, there are different competencies. A test it's a turf thing, but you're not allowed to do that. Well, maybe that one, please.
Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Carrie Rexigal, I'm Executive Director of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, and I'd like to speak to the testing issue. It's my understanding that companies and corporations that own the rights to psychological tests have their own requirements for who may administer such a test, and if somebody has the correct credentials to do so, they can do that. But I also understand it is a turf thing, as you said, maybe between psychologists and other mental health professionals. But that I am aware that the testing companies do determine who can use their tests.
And so, Mr. Chair, this was also an effort to avoid scope creep. And so this will be discussed in some more detail as it goes through the process, and the Senate may have another opinion about how they want to label these things. But it's clear that the licensed professional counselors can do assessments.
Mr.
Chair, as to what testing tools they can do.
Excuse me, Mr. Kelly, I was just wondering if counsel could give an opinion if there's a statutory language difference between test and assessment.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd have to look into it. I can't tell you off the top of my head what the difference is.
Okay. Representative Abler, do you want to go on to another amendment?
More?
Don't we have a 322?
Yeah, okay. Did that pass?
Or did we vote on that?
Was that already done?
We voted on that already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, you can keep that. So, and I appreciate the subtlety, and it's, anyway, so, fair enough. AO50322, Mr. Chair.
What's over here? Oh, we did it. Okay, I was correct then. You have 0322?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'd move that amendment. You want to describe the amendment, Representative Abler?
Mr. Chair, this has to do with transition licensure. Apparently, a very similar version to this was in the original draft and then got dropped along the way. And different people elected at different times. I guess everybody likes it today, Mr. Chair, and the board and the interested people have talked about it. Maybe the Ms. Rice, honestly. Rick's still. What's different? I write it out, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Anyway, so Ms. Rick's still could describe the content of it.
question?
Go ahead.
This is a grandparenting provision which will capture experienced counselors who can't qualify for licensure under the statute as it's written right now. And it's basically what it says. They have a 2-year period to apply for licensure, and they get a break in the number of credits and certain coursework and some of their supervised field experience as part of the general requirements for licensure right now. So I guess that's all I have to say about this. We're happy about this.
Any questions? Okay, then I think I moved Amendment 0322. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment passes. The last one, Mr. Abler.
That's all there is. Nowhere to present the bill. So.
Okay.
There's one more, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
Uh-oh.
And this is the one that's actually the most technical of the three or whatever I'm around to. And just so members understand, as interesting as each of these amendments is, for these folks, it's like conference committee day. And they've been having quite a bit of discussion since Friday to get to the point today. And so many of them have worked out with great subtlety and nuance, and I'm sorry I can't even reflect some of that to you in a better way on that test assessment thing, but it's kind of like that in some of these cases. And so that's why the number of amendments are here today. Some were promised to come, and this is one that was actually brought to us before the meeting, but it was not in time, and so we wanted to give people a chance to look at it. People reviewed it, and they're comfortable. This has to do with the, as you transition the alcohol drug counselors under the new Board of Behavioral Therapy. These are some technical changes that are necessary.
What's the number?
Oh, I'm sorry, the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
A1. Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment.
What, Mr. Jackson?
Representative Peace.
What was the first one we passed?
We did, just before this, we did 0322, and then there was an A2 amendment prior to that one.
And the oral amendment.
The oral amendment.
And then an oral amendment.
The oral amendment. Okay, the A2. All right, that's fine. Okay, thanks.
The A2 simply deleted various sections of the bill. Representative Abler.
Do you want us to give you the specific detail on the technical parts, or we can?
You want to explain your bill?
Oh, did you adopt the amendment? The A1?
No.
Okay,
just A1.
Yeah, do you want to ask the bill?
Mr. Chair,
it's been a long day.
We're getting longer.
This amendment is for alcohol and drug counselors who will come under the authority of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy as of July 1, 2005. And so some of these things are housekeeping things to abolish the advisory council and certain other things that were part of that program because they're no longer necessary. As five of the board members of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy are alcohol and drug counselors. So it's removing them as no longer necessary. And there's also a provision to allow applicants to, in lieu of an oral exam, to complete supervision instead. We had received information from a lot of people that the oral exam was unavailable or difficult to get scheduled or a hindrance to licensure. So the oral exam path is still present, but now we are offering also supervision in lieu of that. That's basically it.
Any questions? Representative Peace.
So this is the same people. This is the same thing we talked about in the last bill. These are the same people?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, President Peason, the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy is the umbrella board under which licensed professional counselors now are, and the alcohol drug counselors are moving into.
And this is how we move those people?
Correct.
Okay.
Next year, they'll just have one bill. Instead of five.
Any further questions? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
Mr. Chair, we'll testify.
Is that it now, Representative Abler?
No more amendments, Mr. Chair. I think that was the last amendment of the day.
Okay.
Do you want to hear about the bill now, Mr. Chair?
You know, next year, if I'm still here doing this, I think we should have like an hour of somebody come in and explain the difference between counselors and social workers and mental health people and chemical dependency counselors. I probably missed three or four.
Psychologists.
A lot of, yeah, psychologists, psychiatrists.
Mr. Chair.
You represent Thiessen.
On that amendment, in subdivision 6, it's talking about a transition period for city council and state agency alcohol and drug counselors. How does that intersect with the last bill that we just heard? Doesn't that cover the same kind of deal?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Representative Abler.
Or maybe that's something that will be worked out before the...
No, I... That's the same. But it's the same section to work on. I think that's a good point. We should probably delete that. Anybody phone a friend here?
We want the last, Mr. Chair.
We want to represent these.
We want the last.
You want 11 and 12 to supersede that.
We could do it later or do it. I suppose we could do it before the next committee if that makes sense.
I think we're all tired now, but I think that, I like the idea about putting these two bills together even better now, Mr. Chair. So maybe we'll have staff do homework and prepare an amendment for this bill that will reflect the changes since, in fact, it's just part of it. So let's just... Let's pass the bill as it is now. Neither is going into law by the time we get to the full committee. And so we'll fix it. It's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that all right? Representative, we'll get this straightened out. So we're going to pass this with good intent tonight.
Oh,
Representative Abler, you want to do the whole bill now? As amended?
I'll,
Mr. Chair.
Got my witness, Mr. Chair.
Well, what's left of the bill?
Yeah, what's left?
What's left of House Bill 637 really is housekeeping now. And I'm not going to go into great detail about what's in here, but many of the additions, which look rather lengthy, are just things that other boards under Chapter 214 already have, and it's bringing the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy in line with the other licensing boards.
That's pretty simple.
Well, I mean, this is actually very complicated, and I will say that I'm a little confused about how these groups interrelate, what each one of them does, and I do know that a lot of these folks that used to work for or still work for cities, counties, state government were never licensed before, even though they were doing pretty much the same work, and we're trying to change that. At the same time, we're upgrading all the educational requirements for everybody in this system. And how you do that all at once is very complicated. So any further discussion on the bill as amended? Representative Thiessen?
Mr. Chair, I think I am going to move to eliminate that Section 16 from the A1 amendment. Because they don't work together, and I just assume we take care of it now. And leave the bill we just passed to fill the space there. If you're...
That's fine. Maybe could Ms. Pinelli comment? Does that seem like that's where the motion can be? Yeah. I appreciate texting that. That's it.
I'm just wondering how we make this motion since the amendment's been adopted. It's in the bill.
We can just motion to delete that section from the bill now.
Okay, right.
That's the most
joy. So your motion is, Representative Thiessen, is to remove section which from the A1 amendment?
16.
Section 16.
A1 amendment.
Everybody understand that?
The idea is the bill we just passed is covered this area and put in place some kind of compromise. And so we don't want to have two contradictory sections.
Okay. Any questions? All those in favor of Representative Thiessen's amendment signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Anything else on 637?
Let's start the darn good bill. I hope we can pass it.
All those in favor of House File 637 as amended And this would be recommended for approval and sent to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Bill passes. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, that's the end of my bills, I think. Isn't the bill on the agenda?
Don't we have 1776, or did we do that?
We did that. That was actually incorporated in the previous work.
Okay.
What else is on the agenda?
That is it, Representative.
I need to do a disclaimer, Mr. Chair. Just in the end, and last time you passed House File 1313, it's on your list of things to pass up to the Finance Committee, which is a fine place to put it. I represent it as being non-controversial. I found out since then, as part of this whole dialogue, and in fact, it's quite controversial. And so you can still make the motion, but that bill needs to be working on the interim time. And so when it comes up to the full committee, I'll be recommending that it be held over there for a good long time until they can work out some of the bugs. So that was my agreement with the group as I'm working with them. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I appreciate your patience on all this stuff.
Sounds like an oral amendment.
No. No, I'm just a... I want to treat this to me with the openness and proper respect.
Representative Abler, we'd like to thank you for keeping us busy on two evenings. And I want to thank the members. Actually, we got done a lot sooner tonight than I thought we would. We got through all our work. I don't think there are any other bills at this time. So this will probably be the last meeting of this subcommittee unless something new happens. And actually, I'm a little serious about sometime next year just having an hour's hearing on these counselors, psychologists, chemical dependency workers, so we get a better understanding of who they are and what they do. So thank you for all your hard work. And we have one more thing to do. Representative Emmer has read the minutes for the last meeting. And would you move those for approval?
So moved.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That's done. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.